They'll beat you with their brains. Jeff Blair, Richard Deitch. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
There are essentially 3 days on the Toronto sports calendar where I really, really like doing this show. I mean, I like doing it all the time. Most of the time. 95% of the time. But opening day for the Blue Jays, still the best. The day the Leafs get eliminated from the playoffs, it's right up there too. And almost, I was going to say almost as regular as the wrap, as the Blue Jays opening day, but let's forget about that for the time. And the third day, Richard Deitch, is the annual let's bitch that the Raptors aren't on TV on Christmas Day. Those are my three favorite days to do this show. It is like shooting fish in a barrel. Today, of course, and I'm going to say this. You know how much I love Sid Sixero. Sid Sixero is the guy that pushed me over the edge here on this thing. I think Raptors fans in general.
I figured it would be Bunkus. I feel like he's always been on the brigade of they don't give us any respect because there's not a game.
Yeah, I don't care. No. Sixero pushed me over the edge here when it comes to this. And I love both those guys. I mean, I don't care. This isn't personal, obviously. But Jesus, people. The fact that the Raptors aren't on the NBA's Christmas schedule. First of all, as much as I love all of you, and I understand that the pandemic has changed the way we live, there are a lot of things you can do on Christmas Day that don't involve watching TV. I'm just going to throw that out there. But secondly, this gets down to the whole idea that we should in any way care about what Americans think about us. Richard, with all due respect, and I'm leaving you aside here. These people have had a turnip for president for the past 4 years. And you people are worried about a lack of respect for your team that won a title 2 years ago? You actually think that's what this is about? Like, seriously? A lack of respect? No, it's that by and large, I hate to say this, unless their team is playing the Toronto Raptors on that particular night, most NBA fans don't give the Raptors a second thought. They just don't, any more than you or I give a second thought about the Charlotte Hornets or even the Milwaukee Bucks. We just don't.
Yep.
We just don't.
By the way, thank you, Travis, for pointing out that I apologize to Bunkus. He actually has the right.
Yes,
on. Jeff.
I just got to go on a little more. The other thing about this year in particular, people. The Raptors are not a feel-good story for the NBA. I mean, I'm sorry. Franchise has to relocate because of a pandemic. That's not a warm and fuzzy Christmas afternoon. Let's sit around the fireplace and worry about freaking COVID-19 story. It's not. This makes my head explode. This is like Derek Fisher circling under a fly ball. This makes me want to strangle somebody or break something. Seriously. I'm going to go on a little bit more, Deitch, and then I'm going to shut up and give you 5 minutes to say whatever the hell
ratings are going up.
I don't know about that. Then somebody reached out to me on Twitter because I, yelled at people in caps about this. And he said, well, wait a minute, Sportsnet cares because on their website, they run a what the other cities are thinking of us, what the American media is thinking of us. My response was, you're right. That's stupid, too. I mean, with all due respect, and I'm not criticizing, hey, do whatever you need to do to get clicks. We all do. I mean, basically, we live in a click world, and that's fine. And look, I have no problem with it. I don't look at it. But I do not understand why any of you give a rat's freaking ass about what somebody like Stephen A. Smith thinks of your country or your team or your city. I don't care. And neither should you. Okay, Deitch, I'm done.
coming out of the gate firing. First of all, you should, as an American, you should absolutely not care about what any American sports talk host or writer or pundit thinks. That's just nonsense. And too many Canadians over the last 20, 30 years cared about that. I do think over the last 4 years, a little bit of the hood has been exposed under the car. Maybe you guys think differently. You, Jeff, the whole Raptors not playing on Christmas Day was always one of the silliest silliest takes I ever heard on the station. It's just utter nonsense. It has nothing to do with, put it in quotes, respect, which in itself is just kind of an overplayed nonsense term. It is basic television economics. Basic television economics. The NBA on Christmas Day, that is their showcase day, essentially, until the postseason. Their only care, their only concern, is to find matchups and teams that will draw viewership for their rights holder partners. They care about nothing else. They care about competitiveness, sure, but at the end of the day, that is all they want. And so, unless the Toronto Raptors are the singular best team in the NBA, with stars coming out of the kazoo, the NBA gets nothing, literally nothing, and ESPN and Turner Sports get nothing out of a Toronto team playing a game because they do not get the Toronto market. They are not able to get the viewership numbers, which they ultimately sell ads against. So it's not about respect. It's not about knocking Toronto. It's simply about the league trying to figure out the best possible viewership story they can for their rights holders. And then furthermore, Jeff, the reality this year, and I think you agree with me, the Toronto Raptors don't have a team that deserves to be on Christmas Day. They're not one of the four best teams in the league. They don't have a transcendent star on that team. So why on earth would the NBA select them when they could select Steph Curry and the Warriors? Or they can select LeBron James and the Lakers? It's always been such a very, very strange one for me.
Yeah, I'm with you completely on that. And Sid pointed out, all the stuff the Raptors are being put through this year and went through last year. It's the least that they can do. Again, I just want to tell people in Toronto, I understand why the Raptors are in Tampa, and I have no problem with it. But rest assured, the NBA does not look at this as a positive story. I mean, no. They don't. Any more than Major League Baseball was, isn't it so great that the Blue Jays are playing in Buffalo?
It's not an NBA market. What? The NBA doesn't care about Tampa?
Exactly.
Gives them nothing.
Exactly. God. I mean, it just can't be that difficult.
I think fan bases, unfortunately.
Bang my head against the wall.
We're all guilty of this. We all, there's a whole us against them mentality when it comes to sports. It's sort of part of the word fanatic. But you do at a certain point, I think, hopefully you step back and you realize that, not everything is intentionally set up to screw you. And on this one, for many years, it was not about the Raptors' lack of respect for. The league respects Toronto. The league wants Toronto to do great. It's their international market. It's theoretically their gateway to going to Mexico City or London or Beijing one day. The league absolutely wants this place to do great. They just get nothing from it in terms of an American television play. And so it's never been about the respect card. And, I get it. It's a nice play for talk show hosts. And, we know Sid loves to take stuff and run with it. His take on Messi was just horrific. I'll never forgive him for that one.
What was his take on Messi again? The famous take on Messi?
He called Messi essentially a fraud because he hadn't won a World Cup.
Well, he's right.
Jeff, both you and Derek.
He is. He is a fraud. Well, he's not a fraud. He's a very good player who can't win the big match.
Leo Messi doesn't he doesn't create the other 10 players around him.
He does. Actually, he does.
Now Derek's fired up.
Well, because they are. The Argentines post-Maradona are the greatest collection of international chokers when it comes to soccer. Well,
that might be so, but I mean, the teams that have won the World Cup have had multiple transcendent players, not a singular player.
I don't know. The
Zidane
German team
is not
won
the reason France won the World Cup.
The German team that won the World
Cup. He may have been the centerpiece of
players.
It, but he's not the singular reason.
Well, the German team that won the World Cup had some good players, but I mean, I don't know if I'd call them necessarily transcendent. I mean, maybe Manuel Neuer, the best keeper in the world.
Best keeper in the world.
Maybe.
You don't think Lewandowski has been a transcendent scorer?
Richard, he's Polish.
Lewandowski's Polish. Who am I thinking of? Mueller? Thomas Mueller. Maybe I'm killing my own argument here.
Yeah, you should. We should just move on. We'll be joined, by the way, by Jeff Perlman, author of the Three Rings.
Is Beckenbauer still playing for
Phil
the Germans, or did he retire?
Stop it. Kobe, Shaq, Phil, in the crazy years of the Lakers dynasty. And Perlman's also working on a book on Bo Jackson, who, of all the athletes out there that have not really had a deep, deep, deep dive done on him, I find him the most intriguing. Especially because he also appears to have lost his mind when it comes to politics as well. So I'm sure Perlman. I wonder if I could ask.
Wait,
Jeff,
are you mistaking Bo for Herschel Walker?
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm mistaking Bo for Herschel Walker. We're tied one apiece.
Actually, the thing about Bo Jackson is he's pretty quiet about everything. That's kind of what makes him interesting.
True.
He sort of went away and like the mythology grew. Herschel Walker is nothing. Herschel Walker is might as well be. Honestly, like the White House press secretary, he's essentially become a Trump honk on Twitter. Yeah, that New Jersey Generals money, Jeff, was obviously pretty good.
I was going to say, I was absolutely, going to say that. The Baltimore are they playing? The last we heard, are they going to play the Ravens and the Steelers? Have they dragged enough guys out of sick bay that they're going to play? Yeah. Have we heard
this? Goodell spoke on a conference call today. I don't think the game was canceled, but maybe Lindsey Jones, one of our guests later, can tell us what he said. But as of now, as of 2:14 p.m. Eastern time, this game is on.
The Ravens activated 10 guys from their practice squad. I mean, I'm not lying. I shouldn't laugh. It's not funny. I don't want anybody to get sick. I really don't. And if anybody's sick, obviously we hope you get better. We pray for you, all this stuff. But the Ravens activated 10 guys from their practice squad for this game. I'm sure it's going to be a dandy. Anyhow, at least they're going to play it. We mentioned that Jeff Perlman's going to join us. I don't know if this is necessarily a surprise, but I would be willing to bet that Giannis Antetokounmpo probably took a look at this and thought, no, that's interesting. LeBron has signed a 2-year extension with the Lakers, and we'll be joined by Dan Wojcicki later on. Again, I don't think that's necessarily a surprise, but it's a good bit of business to get out of the way if you want to get Giannis Antetokounmpo in. Did we lose Richard?
Yeah, no, I'm here. Again, this reminds me of like the Toronto Christmas Day thing. We got to forget about Giannis and just focus on development here for the Raptors.
So which pisses you off more, Giannis or Christmas? See, I get Giannis. I get the yearning, or the Raptors and Christmas.
Christmas does. Yeah, like Giannis. I'm with you. Like I think that's while I think it's ridiculous. I remember McCowan used to always say, "There, why not trade for LeBron James?" Like it's never going to happen. But I like the idea of the fantasy because it allows you to dream. So I have no problems with Raptor fans dreaming of having cap space to sign Giannis, which would obviously be a transcendent signing in this city. I don't think it's going to happen. But I have no problem with that. I think that's actually kind of cool. The Christmas Day stuff is just nonsense because it's just so conspiratorial where there really honestly is no conspiracy. I actually think, Jeff, as a basketball question, I know we don't even have to talk about this because we're going to talk about this for the next year and plus, is if Giannis is not on the market, like I'm fascinated by if there's any other high profile free agent to be that one would consider Toronto, and perhaps more importantly that Toronto might consider, because the guys who are available are not necessarily like, you know what I'm saying, like an absolute perfect fit for the franchise, you know, including Kawhi, who I don't think would come back here, Paul George, who's got a million questions now about his playoff performance, you know, DeMar, Oladipo. So you know what I'm saying, like there's some very good players, but it's not like there's a perfect fit the way Giannis is a perfect fit.
No, I think if you don't have Giannis, there's no star out there that is going to join your team and instantly transform you.
You could make
your team better. And here's the thing: I mean, if Pascal and OG develop the way you think they're going to develop, then I think you're looking probably for a different commodity. You know, you can get, let me rephrase that. You can get by without Giannis and have a really, really good team. Maybe even a team that wins the conference, especially if he gets, if he goes to the West. You can do that if Pascal and OG continue to develop. I really do. And if you got Pascal, OG, and Fred VanVleet as sort of your foundation, I think you can make it work. I'm just not as – I never was all in on the they absolutely need to get Giannis thing. I'm just not. I never have been.
The one thing about him that just makes him different, like in terms of like a free agent, is, you know, first off, his age, you know, he's young and like relatively for a free agent, and like he's not even in his prime yet. And then, like you said, he's a unicorn in that he's a 6'11", 7 foot, like world class athlete who has guard skills. Like, it just doesn't, like, those people don't, they're not human. Anthony Davis and Giannis, they're just not many of them. And that's where he fundamentally changes. And then the thing about Toronto, and I get this part because this is a real part, he does have a relationship with Masai, and that's a factor. And the other thing is, and Jeff, I've talked about this many times, as an international player, as a European, I think he looks at playing in Toronto far differently than the American-born player. Like, to me, Giannis sees Toronto as cosmopolitan, world-class, international, interesting, where a person growing up in the States might look at Toronto as cold, high taxes, in the middle of nowhere kind of thing. And it's just different kind of mindset. And that's where I think if you're a Raptors fan, you're like, you know what? It's not crazy to think Giannis would choose us as a destination and not just the de facto he's going to L.A. or Miami.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not. I don't know. I will say this about Giannis. It's the same reason that baseball players from the Dominican Republic generally don't complain about playing in Toronto and generally didn't complain, believe it or not, about playing in Montreal. And that was because they're not afraid of the passport thing doesn't bother them because they're used to having to flash
exactly.
their passport. I mean, it just
though, don't you think? They're just used to travel. Like, it doesn't.
Yes.
They grow
yes,
up.
They're used to going to other cultures.
Honestly, a lot of coddled American athletes, and maybe coddled's the wrong word, like they're not, they don't really, you know, there's not, once you become a pro, there's not a ton of hardships in terms of the travel and stuff like that. You certainly might have had hardships as a kid, don't get me wrong. That's a different kind of hardship. But I'm with you.
American,
I think, like, the Dominican guys are like, we travel all the time. Like, what's the big deal to cross another border?
And, you know, the American guys, American professional athletes, by and large, are the only ones that don't have to leave their country.
Correct.
To have a good career. Let me rephrase that, because obviously if you're a Spanish soccer player, a German soccer player, or an English soccer player, you can play in your country and have a great career. But what I'm saying is Spanish players have no problem going to Germany. German players have no problem going there. I mean, depending on the type of English player, a guy like Gary Lineker, as English as they come, he had no problem going overseas to play. Soccer players generally, if you say to a soccer player, this is a great opportunity, you're not only going to make more money, but it's a cool opportunity, they will consider it. It's just, it's American-born athletes, maybe with the exception of hockey players, that, ooh, I don't want to cross the border because I might have
it's a geography thing, Jeff. I mean, it's a big landmass, and you, generally speaking, can, let's take baseball and football. You don't really have to leave because you can train in what's a very large country. I will say, though, that we have seen, at least in the last 10, 15 years, Jeff, the young American soccer player does travel a lot to foreign countries or could go to
Germany,
a foreign academy.
Especially.
Yeah,
yes.
But that's a specialist, right? And, like, the same thing with track. Like, it's just
absolutely
certain sports. But by and large, the big sports in the States, the athletes, for the most part, unless rare exceptions, are mostly staying in the States until they become pros.
Yeah, and let's face it, and I know up against the clock here, and Jeff Perlman will join us, so Derek, and we'll take a break in a minute here. But let's face it as well. If you are a North American soccer player, if you really want to test yourself against the best of the best of the best, you're going to go to Europe. You are. Plus, you're going
you
to make
have
more
to.
Money. Plus, yeah, you're going to make more to. Money. So, you know, that's just the way it is. 595.90 is a text line, by the way. I asked the question on social media if the annual let's whine about the Raptors not being on Christmas Day on TV is just about the lamest, stupidest, most idiotic sports take that we have. I'm sorry, Sid. I love you, but God damn, this makes me mad. Anyhow, it's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. .590 is a text line if you want to whine about my whining about, people whining about the Raptors not playing on Christmas Day. Leo Routens, Raptors TV analyst, joins us at the top of the hour. Lindsey Jones, senior NFL writer with The Athletic. I promise not to call her Lindsey Hunter. I don't know why I have the Lindsey Hunter thing. It's like Barry Bobby Bonds. She'll be along at 325.
At least you didn't call her Vinnie Johnson.
No, I don't know why. Lindsey Hunter, it's a thing. Todd Hundley and Randy Hundley. I used to
Lindsey Hunter
all
was
the time.
Lindsey Hunter was an excellent offensive guard. He was a fun guy to watch.
But
that's a weird one because it's not like he was a Toronto legend or anything.
So. Oh, and Lindsey's such a great writer. Anyhow, whatever. Someone get in my ear and remind me about that. Dan Wojcik, he's a national basketball writer with the LA Times. He will join us to discuss LeBron James' reported new two-year, $85 million extension. Brian Burke as well. He'll return after a couple of weeks off, and we'll talk to him about it being the 25th anniversary of Patrick Roy's last game with the Montreal Canadiens. It indeed was a lost game with the Montreal Canadiens. Still a day that I remember being just absolutely. I was working in Montreal. I was just stunned when that story broke. I was just absolutely blown away when that story broke. So Brian Burke will join us. We'll take a look at some of the latest news out of the NHL. Gary Bettman with some interesting comments today at a sports business seminar, going out of his way to describe the discussions with the NHL Players Association as not being a renegotiation. And I understand what he's saying, and I kind of agree with it, but I'm not certain it's necessarily been painted that way to the NHL player, the group as a whole. But we'll talk to Brian Burke about that. There's a lot to talk about, obviously. We mentioned that LeBron James has reportedly agreed to a new two-year contract extension. I mean, in my lifetime, there are kind of three iterations, if you want to call it that, of the Lakers. There's the Showtime Lakers, you know, with Magic and James Worthy and Kareem. And I mean, when I started watching hoops, Richard, you're either a Bird or a Magic guy. You just were. You know, I'll admit, I think the first basketball game I watched that really, really excited the hell out of me. I mean, I like Dr. J and all these guys, but the first game I watched that excited the hell out of me was that Indiana State Michigan State game. That's where I kind of thought, all right. So you're either a Bird or a Magic guy. I always had an issue because I consider myself a Bird guy. But I loved watching Showtime. Showtime turned me into a basketball fan, even though Larry Bird was my favorite player. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's how it worked. Then you had, of course, the latest iteration of the Lakers, which are a really good team, but I find them completely uninteresting. Then you have the other Lakers dynasty, if I'm going to call it that, if I can call it that. You've got the Kobe, Shaq, Phil Jackson sort of thing. The book is Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. It's a terrific book by a terrific writer, Jeff Perlman. We're very pleased that Jeff joins us on Writer's Block. Jeff, thanks so much for doing this, man. I hope you and your family are doing well through all this. And we'll talk about your Bo Jackson book in a few minutes as well, because I really want to ask you just why it seems as if he's a guy that not a lot gets written about. But I want to talk about this book in particular, and I'm going to ask you, I know at your heart you're a reporter. What team would you have rather covered, Showtime or the Kobe, Shaq, Phil Lakers?
Well, I do want to say that Lindsey Hunter was actually a member, briefly, of the Kobe, Shaq, Phil Lakers.
There you go.
Maybe that's why you're getting Lindsey Jones and Lindsey Hunter confused. I think I'd go Showtime, to be honest. I just think I'm kind of like you. Like, I remember being a kid in New York and watching the Lakers-Celtics games, and when they were at the Forum, they'd always do the wide shot, and you'd come in, and they'd show a little bit of the coastline, and they'd show palm trees, and there'd be Magic Johnson and the Laker girls and Jack Nicholson courtside. And it just had a real, maybe because I was young, but it just had a real mystique to me that, you know, we were all adults when Shaq and Kobe were playing, and it's everything's a little less magical when you see it through the prism of adulthood. So for me, the Showtime Lakers would be, that'd be kind of dreamy.
Jeff, I know we did this on my podcast, so I may ask you a very similar question, but your answers on this stuff were really interesting.
Answer it in Canadian, though.
Yeah, I will. Jeff. It was for you. You did this book, and I know you are certainly well known in our business for doing like a crazy amount of interviews. You like interviewing people who are sort of the last person on a roster because it gives such great insight. But so much of this book, Jeff, of course, is sort of Kobe Bryant and who he was, you know, before he became Kobe Bryant with a capital K. He passed away prior to the book being published. And I just wonder for you, like, how surreal an experience was it for you to have a book out on this after Kobe dies tragically, you know, doing this entire book, obviously never in a million years conceiving that would happen when the book comes out.
Yeah, it was not fun. I mean, I'm book came out about, you know, a little while ago, so I'm able to look back at it a little bit, and it sucked. It really sucked. I mean, the day he died, I was sitting in a coffee shop. The book was completed, and a friend of mine texted me and just said, "You know, rumors Kobe Bryant died this morning." And I just couldn't believe it. I really couldn't get my head around it. And the truth of the matter is, after sort of the shock of it all passed, I had a lot of nervousness about it because the book—it's not overly. I wouldn't say it's cruel to Kobe Bryant, but I can't say it's overly kind to him either. During that period, 96-04, he wasn't the easiest teammate, wasn't the easiest guy to get along with. He was definitely a kind of confusing character. And so teammates weren't, it's not like sitting down with Samaki Walker or Shaq or these guys, they were love letters to Kobe. They were pretty hard on him and felt like he had a lot of weaknesses and they kind of wanted to get it out. But then he dies and you're promoting a book and the book's done and all these sentiments are in the book. It was just really uncomfortable. The whole promoting of this book, it's the most uncomfortable I've ever been promoting a book, ever.
Did you get any blowback for that? Not on social media, but I mean from players, readers?
Zero, actually. I mean, there's a couple of, like, you know, every now and then you look at your, like, Amazon reviews and there'll be some, you know, one-star review and some guy will be like, disrespect to Kobe. But I didn't get none of the players, none of the coaches, I didn't hear a thing from Dini or Phil. It was negative. So shockingly, no. But I think I do think one of the big things is it wasn't a secret. Like it's not like the book came out and people are like, oh my God, Eagle Colorado, that happened. Or, oh my God, he was a difficult teammate. Like it wasn't, but maybe the details were a little sort of, some of the details were new and the reporting was new, but it wasn't like there was never an idea out here in California that Kobe was a choir boy, that Kobe was perfect. So I think that probably made it a little easier, to be honest.
Jeff, Shaquille O'Neal seems to have a great reputation with his teammates after his career. You know, you hear people talk about playing with him, and there seems to be a joy to their stories. It's different with Kobe. I think everybody who played with Kobe respected his maniacal desire to win, maniacal desire for preparation. But it's not as warm as it is with Shaq. So I wonder, from talking to the people that you talked to back then, when you profiled the sort of the Phil Kobe Lakers, like, was it that, like, in real time? Like, did people love Shaq just personally and maybe just come to admire Kobe's ruthlessness even if they didn't like him personally?
See, I think at the time, if people are being honest, I just think Kobe was a pain in the ass to play with. I just do. I mean, I think people are always in awe of his talent and his ruthlessness on the court, but he was difficult. You know, there were a lot of 8 for 24 shooting nights, 6 for 17 shooting nights, where he would you know, wouldn't let there be a wide open Rick Fox or a wide open Robert Orr, and he wasn't looking. Where Shaq would be demanding the ball down low, and he wasn't dumping it down low. He just was really difficult to play with during that period. He really was, and he was difficult to coach. And you could talk to any of the three guys who coached him during that run, Del Harris, Kerr Rambis, or Phil, and they all say the same thing. The guy had a marvelous talent. He could be charming, and he could be endearing, and he was incredibly intelligent. But on the court, he was not one who was going to – he didn't love the triangle offense. He was at his worst when they were playing guys like an Iverson or Vince Carter, and he felt like he had to take it to him one-on-one. Teammates knew it was going to be a long night. It was going to be early on when they were playing Jordan. You know, you weren't going to get the ball. Like, you knew you weren't going to get the ball. I thought that it was really interesting talking to guys who played with him. In 96 and 97, he played on the Lakers summer league team. And these are all guys trying to make the team, right? So they're guys like DeJuan Wheat and David Booth, and they're trying to make the Lakers. And you have a teammate who will not pass you the ball, who's going to shoot 35 times. If you're DeJuan Wheat was a point guard out of Louisville on the 97 team, said to me, there's nothing worse than being a point guard on a summer league team with Kobe Bryant when you're trying to show your coaches that you can find the open man and you can pass. And this guy doesn't even get you. He doesn't even let you bring up the ball. So he was just really difficult, and Shaq wasn't. You know, Shaq wasn't. Shaq, first of all, Shaq had this thing about him. He still does, I think, where he just wanted to make you happy. And he wanted you to appreciate it. That's it. But he wanted to make you happy. He wanted to fly your parents into your first game. He wanted to buy you your first suit. He was never going to let teammates pay for a meal. He bought everyone Rolexes. He just wanted you to be happy. And the only thing he asked in return is that you were kind of affectionate about it, you know? And that was it. So he was just very different than Kobe.
You know, one of the things I always found interesting about Shaq and, being around him a little bit in post-game scrums and things of this nature, and obviously not as often as a lot of NBA writers did, but I've been able to do it like 5 or 6 times. And I think you see it with a lot of really good, big, large NBA players. I wonder if part of this isn't, Jeff, that he's so used to being the biggest guy in the room. And, you know, any room he goes into, he's the biggest guy physically. And people are looking at him. I just got the sense that Shaq was and is so comfortable in his skin. You know, for a very large man, for like a superhuman-sized human being, he's very comfortable just being in areas and kind of knowing, maybe this comes from, I don't know, scaring people when he was younger. I don't know, but he just seems to have this sense, this ability of making other people kind of comfortable around him. And I noticed that again, just from scrums even.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I think it's really interesting because we started this by talking about comparing the Showtime Lakers to these Lakers. And, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, a man of, you know, also enormous size, was the exact opposite. When they would be in airports, he'd be sitting in a stall, in a bathroom stall, reading a book so people wouldn't approach him. He hated autograph seekers. He hated the attention. He just hated it and recoiled at it. And Shaq ate it up. I just think some people have that personality. Some people know how to own their fame. And, you know, it's funny, like Kobe, and this sounds like I'm disparaging him. I'm not. I'm really not. I have a lot of respect for Kobe Bryant. It's just sort of who he was at the time. You know, he would show up at training camp, and he'd have 2, 3, 4 bodyguards. And Shaq would always say to him, what the F do you need bodyguards for? And here's Shaq, who's as recognizable as anyone in the country at the time. And he didn't, you know, he just kind of, he had his one guy, Uncle Jerome, who always traveled with him and technically was a bodyguard. But he wasn't hiding from the public. You know, he embraced the public. And I don't think he understood the idea of sort of the Kobe approach or the Michael Jackson approach, where you're always having, you know, you're always having people around you guarding, blocking people out. Like he lathered in the affection.
I do want to move on and talk about Bo Jackson. It's Jeff Perlman, author of 3 Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. But before you do that, I wanted to ask you about when you did this book, was there a Laker player that, other than these three, clearly these guys are the focal point here, but was there a guy you came away thinking, God, that was just, it was a great interview. Like a guy you came away thinking, I just love this guy, that maybe you weren't expecting to feel that way about going into the book.
Well, I would say the shocking one was J.R. Ryder, who only was there for one season. Yeah, and his I couldn't get in touch with him. I ended up knocking on his door, and I thought he was going to punch me in the face. Like, he was not very agreeable to when I could basically, you know, J.R. Ryder was kind of a head case when he was an NBA player. Not even kind of, he was a head case. And he played one season with the Lakers. I really wanted to talk with him. I couldn't get a phone number, so I drove out to his house in Arizona and knocked on the door. And he was like, "What are you doing here?" And I'm like, "You know, I'm a writer." He's like, "Nah, man, no. And he comes out, and I swear to God, I thought the guy was going to punch me in the face. He's like, "Dude, you don't just drive up to someone's house. It's not cool. What are you working on?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm doing a Laker book." "All right, I'll talk to you." And he gave me like 2 hours of great and was really thoughtful and smart and could speak as an opponent as well as a player. And he was great. Mike Penberthy, a little known guard from Masters College, was great. Rick Fox was great. Samaki Walker was outstanding. Just a wealth of information. So, a lot of really good guys.
Jeff, we want to ask you about the Bo Jackson book because, we spoke briefly at the top of the show about, Bo Jackson is a mythological figure given his college career at Auburn, his remarkable playing of two sports, Raiders and the Royals, and just doing some crazy stuff. And then I think, Jeff, and maybe this is what attracted you to the story. It's not like Bo Jackson's post athletic life. Like, he's not in our face all the time. I know he's done some stuff, and I think he's done some stuff with food, but you know what I'm saying? Like, he's not a pitch. We haven't seen him every single day as a pitch man. And so it would strike me that probably part of your exploration of this guy is just he's not crazily enough for a guy who was that incredible as an athlete. He's not necessarily overexposed, at least in 2020.
I agree 100%. A couple of things that are funny. Number one, I almost never, when I'm working on a book, talk about what I'm working on until the book's out. And I interviewed David Cohn because he played with him with the Royals. And a couple of days later, I didn't tell anyone I'm doing this book. I was just keep going about my business. And David Cohn is a Yankee broadcaster. And during a Yankee game, he's sitting there with Michael Kay. In the middle of the broadcast, he goes, "Not sure if you heard, Mike, but Jeff Pearlman working on a book about Bo Jackson." And I was like, "Oh, there goes that one." And all of a sudden, everyone's DMing me about writing a Bo Jackson book. He, which is cool because, like, I agree with you. He's such an interesting story. He really is mythological. And I feel like it's almost like if he went on to be Eric Dickerson in football or Albert Bell in baseball, he's not nearly as interesting. Like, what's interesting is he just vanished. He was this thing. He's enormous. Somehow my kids have heard of him. Most people seem to know who he is. His YouTube clips still generate millions and millions of views. Him climbing up the wall, the Bosworth run, 91-yard run down the sideline. Like, just the throws, the Harold Reynolds throw. Like, he's this mythological creature who lives on in, like, Tecmo Bowl talk, Bo Nose commercials, and about 30 ridiculous plays you can find on YouTube. And then he kind of vanished to suburban Chicago, where he lives happily and very quietly.
Yeah, he's I know you reached out on social media and essentially said, "Hey, I'm doing a book on Bo Jackson. You got any leads? You want to talk about him? DM me." What's the response been like from guys who played with him or opponents in all the sports?
Yeah, it's been huge. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I wasn't doing that, and then David Cohn outed me, and then I was like, "Well, I'm outed. I might as well do this." And it's been very helpful. A lot of the thing that's interesting about him. He's not warm and fuzzy, Bo Jackson, at all. And people, you know, he's not – like, he actually put a sign up in his locker when he was playing with the Royals. It was a sign, and it said, "Do not bother me with football questions." And it was literally hanging there in his locker. And he meant it. And he would have – baseball teammates would ask him to sign a football, and he was like, "No, I'm not going to do it." He was like, "Well, you're really not going to sign for me?" "No, I'm not doing it. I don't sign football stuff." He could be very guarded and very prickly. But the stuff he did, just the number of athletic feats. People, just one, like, just as an example, is someone told me one time Bo Jackson was standing in a pool. It was waist deep. And he jumped flat-footed onto the lip of the pool. And it sounds like, oh, not a big deal. But, like, there's a million stories like that where people are like, I just don't know how physically he did that. It's really fun. It's really fun.
Jeff, listen, we really appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much for your time. Stay safe. Be well. The Three Ring Circus is a terrific book, and we really look forward. I can tell you this. I'm really looking forward to the Bo Jackson book as well, because you're right. I mean, I covered a little bit of his baseball career. I actually saw him in spring training a fair amount, but I'd forgotten about him, man. Like, I had literally forgotten about him. I never think of him other than I see those YouTube clips.
Well, I just want to say, because you brought up Lindsey Hunter and then you brought up Vinnie Johnson, I'm now inspired to make my book after Bo Jackson, The Fennis Denbo Story. So thank you for inspiring me.
There you go. Thanks, Jeff.
Cover of Sports Illustrated.
Fennis Denbo.
Thank you.
One of the great names of all time. Be well, Jeff. Thanks for this.
All right. Thanks. Thanks a lot. See you.
See you, Jeff.
Jeff Perlman, author of Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. Look, if you are a basketball fan, you know, don't even be a Lakers fan. If you're a basketball fan, you got to read this. It is, because it is kind of, if you're a hoops fan, there are sort of three Lakers teams, right, Richard? There are three Lakers teams, basically.
If you're a Lakers fan, there's multiple sort of Laker dynasties that you can sink your teeth into. The thing about one of the things that Perlman has been really, really smart about is, one, he's sort of very, very obsessive compulsive just in his reporting. So he interviews like 300 people, but he's always been able to get like these bench guys or these people who are part of the team who don't necessarily have any kind of major role on the wins and losses, but they were there. You know what I mean, Jeff? Like, they were in the room next to the Kobe Bryants or the Daryl Strawberries. And, you know, at a certain age, like, these people talk. Like, they're willing to share what happened. And Perlman usually gets just some great stuff in his books because he tracks down the right people who just are willing to talk. You know, I mean, I don't know what the example would be on, like, the Maple Leafs, but maybe if like you were doing a book on last year, 25 years from now, like you talk to Travis Dermott or something like that, you know what I mean? Or you talk to Alex Kerfoot and they gave you like all the insight on Matthews and Marner and Tavares. And so he's very smart just in how he approaches these books.
Yeah, that is the interesting thing when you do a book is when you find that guy who gives you just that nugget, the stuff you can build a whole chapter around that you didn't know. It's just the only way you get that is by legwork. I mean, when I did my Jays book, I ended up talking to the head of Canadian scouting for Major League Baseball, and we were just talking about sort of the development of baseball players in Canada. And this guy drops a story in my lap about how one of the regional scouts sent in a report on Sidney Crosby as a baseball player. And he didn't know Sidney Crosby was a hockey player. I guess he was an American guy who went up and saw Sidney Crosby. He files a report. And this guy said back, he is a great athlete, but trust us, he's not going to be around in the 35th round, the NHL draft. He's going into the NHL. But you find stuff like that when it just falls in your lap. And you're right. Perlman's books are full of little nuggets like that. So the Bo Jackson book's going to be spectacular. I mean, first of all, any book, now that I know that David Cohn's quoted in the book, I'm buying it regardless of where it goes from there, because there are very few people I've ever interviewed as good as David Cohn talking about anything.
Yeah.
His memory is encyclopedic.
Analyst.
His memory's encyclopedic. I talked to him about baseball negotiations one time, and he was pulling stuff out about sitting in a room with Gene Orza at the back of the White House when President Clinton tried to get the baseball owners and players. And he's talking about what was in the room and what they were drinking and what they were nibbling on. I thought, Jesus. And it was right. I checked out. He was right. We've got a big 3 o'clock hour ahead. Lindsey Jones, not Lindsey Hunter, will join us to talk NFL. Leo Routens, he's our Raptors TV analyst on Sportsnet. He'll be along to talk Raps. Dan Wojcicki as well. LeBron James has agreed to a new 2-year extension. Lots to talk about. We'll get you set for it. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Leo Routens will join us in a few minutes. The Raptors are starting training camp in lovely Tampa, Florida. And, Leo will get us caught up to date in that. Tell us what to see, what to look ahead to. A little bit of interesting news here. Of course, you know that 8 o'clock tonight is the non-tender deadline. It's going to be a lot of free agent players out there as a result of that. We've already seen some names. John Heyman's reporting that the Blue Jays are now linked with Gene Segura, a shortstop slash second baseman who I believe is still under contract as of this moment, the Philadelphia Phillies. I don't know if he's been DFA'd or whatever. But he ain't Francisco Lindor. But my guess is he'd be somebody's plan B or maybe even somebody's plan C. Rest assured, it's the first of many rumors you're going to hear tonight. And you know what? You're going to hear it here first. You're going to read it first on Sportsnet.ca. Leo Routens is next. Don't go anywhere. Lindsey Jones will join us in a few minutes to get you set for that Baltimore Ravens, Pittsburgh Steelers game. Richard Deitch, I'm going to give you some numbers here. We've got Leo Routens here. I want to talk about the Raptors in a minute, but just dug up this nugget from Dejan Kovacevic, who is covering the Steelers-Ravens game tonight. The Ravens roster for tonight's game will have 36 players, which is 9 short of what they normally have, correct? Am I right? 45?
That sounds right.
8 of them are going to be making their NFL debuts, and which is kind of interesting. No one is playing who wouldn't have been eligible if the game were played last night. So that's just a little bit of background in this game. But that's remarkable. I'm not surprised. It's just when you put the numbers, when you view the numbers like that, it's remarkable.
I mean, we'll see what happens, Jeff, but I think if you're in much the same way the Saints-Broncos game, I just don't know how the Ravens are competitive in this game. I mean, we'll ultimately see, but it strikes me the NFL is just trying to get past this game and they move on.
Mm. We mentioned the Toronto Raptors are in Tampa. They're home away from home this season. They're starting training camp. Nick Nurse and Norm Powell did media availabilities today. It was interesting, Leo Routens, who's our Raptors radio analyst, Raptors TV analyst, joins us. Leo, thank you for doing this as always. But based on the questions that Bobby Webster was asked yesterday, based on the questions that Nick Nurse got, I guess it stands to reason that because Serge and Mark aren't around, there's going to be a lot of focus on Aaron Baines. But I'd be interested in what you think of Aaron Baines in terms of what he is going to bring to this team. I don't know if he's necessarily going to replace Serge or Mark, but what is he going to bring to this team that might force some other players around him to do stuff differently, you know, because he's a different player than those guys?
Well, first of all, good afternoon. Good to be here. Well, here's the funny thing. When all these names are being thrown around and all of a sudden Mark's gone and Serge is gone, the whole time I'm sitting at home going, Aaron Baines. Aaron Baines. Come on. So, Aaron Baines, right? I kept looking. His name was there, and he made perfect sense for this team. Because, as you said, I mean, he's not Serge, he's not Mark, but he's pretty darn good. And you're talking about an experienced guy who's got championship pedigree. He's extremely physical. That's what I love about him. I mean, all those Australian dudes, man, they don't mind banging. They play a little rugby when they're out there. And they bring it every time they step on the floor. He's developed his shot. I mean, he can stretch you out. And you look at how Marc Gasol has struggled, you know, in the last year with that shot. Well, so I think a distinct improvement on a guy that can knock down the three. He runs the floor extremely well, and he knows how to play. I have a lot of respect for Australian guys because, one, as I said, they're physical, and two, they know how to play. They're exposed to the game at an early level. They learn the game the right way. And so I think the Raptors by committee, they're going to do a really good or adequate job of replacing the two that they lost. But Aaron Baines, you know, takes that committee to a new level. I mean, I think that he gives the Raptors a serious player in that position that I think can complement the core.
Leo, I mean, you know, it remains to be seen, obviously, what these guys are. I think the loss of Serge is big, and we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, there's rightfully a lot of talk about OG and his development this year, and I expect him to have a terrific year. And we'll see what Pascal comes back with after a postseason that he didn't like. But I'm really fascinated because I think this guy becomes such a key part of the team given the increased minutes, and that's Chris Boucher, who now I think realistically has to play, you know, between like 17 and 22 minutes a game. And he's really like a massive X factor because if he's hitting threes, he becomes like a real difference maker given his length, and he's a tough guy to guard. If he doesn't, then, you know, offensively, it gets a little tricky for them. You've seen him pretty much every game in his NBA career. Do you think the moment will be too big for him, or do you think this is a guy now with increased minutes maybe makes his mark on the league this year?
Well, you know, that's what we're going to find out. And when I said, you know, this position, you know, filling that gap with those other two guys is going to be by committee, you know, Chris Boucher could be a big part of that committee. Let's make no mistake that the two wild cards in this team are going to be OG and Pascal, without a doubt. They could determine where this team goes by their development and at what level they get to. But for Chris Boucher, I think that's the big question. You know, in spot duty here and there, you get extended minutes. Otherwise, you come in, you do your thing, you sit down. It's hard to gauge what's going to happen when you have to do it every night for an extended period of time. And again, you're not talking about 30, 40 minutes, but for Chris Boucher, that could be 15 to 25 minutes. Who knows? Somewhere in there. So what's he going to do for that extended time? I think we're all anxious to see that. He's shown me enough that I believe that he can do it. But here's some things that have to happen. You can't lose your energy. All right. Now if you become a rotation guy, one of the things that you bring to the table is energy. That has to happen every game. You know, defensively, he's a unique shot blocker. He's not that traditional guy that's sitting there waiting for you. He'll block a three. He'll block a guy going to the rim. He'll block a guy trying to dunk it. He gets you in all kinds of different situations because of his mobility. But the key now is can you stay out of foul trouble as your rotation guy and be smart and know where you can take chances, where you can't. And then offensively is, yeah, everybody loves. I mean, you know, we'd always joke around how long it take Chris to get a shot up. Well, I love that aggressiveness. I love that fearlessness. But now it's a question of making good decisions. And he's talked about this himself. If you're a rotation guy, you got to, you know, it's not just come in and get it up. You have to be, you know, make good decisions with the ball. You can't turn it over. You got to take good shots. You got to make your shots. But he brings a lot to the table. So, I think he's going to be one of the interesting questions for Nick Nurse and his team. I know how he responds to the opportunity if he does get the extended minutes. And I'll be honest, I'm anxious to see exactly what happens because he's shown that he has all the tools. Now I think this part is going to be as much mental as anything else.
Leo, this is the only time I'm going to ask you this. I promise you this because I made a pact that I would only ask Grange about it once. I would only ask Matt about it once. I'd only ask you about it once, Smith about it once, and Jonesy about it once. So I look back at the playoffs against Boston, and I loved it when Nick Nurse went small. I loved it when he used OG as kind of the small ball five. And you have Powell and OG and Pascal and Norm and Fred Kyle and Fred in the floor. Do you think we're going to see that a lot this year?
You know, I don't know if we'll see it a lot. Here's the thing, you know, how are the new guys going to play out, right? And also depends on too, again, you know, what level does OG and Pascal get to, you know, what level do they get to? How does Baines fit into this core group? Does Chris Boucher respond? Does Alex Len give you the opportunity to give you spot duty and change the game for a few minutes here and there? Once we know all those things, and the great thing about Nick is that if he feels that there's a there's a good opportunity to break a game open or change the way things are going, he'll go small and he'll stay that way for a while. He's not afraid to do that. And here's the catch. When I look at Pascal, and he's another guy I'm really anxious to see. He struggled in a bubble, right? No question about that. I think he was disappointed. I think the organization was disappointed. Fans were disappointed. But anytime he's been in situations in his young career where he hasn't responded or he struggled, he's come back stronger, really focused. And because, he's a guy that can score inside, step out outside, bring you energy, be a factor, especially in small ball, man. If you go small ball and he's a guy that's attacking the rim and looking to create opportunities down low, it gives you a lot more incentive and a lot more realistic opportunities to play small. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how Pascal responds to everything that's happened, over this past season coming into this one. I like the fact that I've been hearing he's back, he's been back in LA, getting in his runs, doing all that, because I think during that COVID break, prior to the bubble, Pascal wasn't able to do what he normally does. And he's very much a rhythm guy. And I saw a guy playing with no rhythm in the bubble. So hopefully he's got that back and a renewed focus, because that could really impact, along with OG, what happens in small ball.
Leo, the Raptors the Raptors have a tricky situation to navigate at the moment with Terrence Davis. Ultimately, there's a players' union, and there's league guidelines, and there's protocol for this kind of stuff. But it's also an organization that has made very, very clear that they have a certain culture and that they have expectations, and that any hint of criminality, or in this case, alleged domestic violence, is not acceptable and will not be tolerated on that club. We've seen some media people already write columns that the Raptors are being hypocritical by Terrence Davis showing up. There is certainly another side to this argument in that they have to wait for the process to play out, both in the New York City court as well as with players' union grievances. So I really just want your thoughts on what is at the moment not an easy situation for any front office, and particularly a front office that really has made it clear that culture matters to them.
Oh, no question. I think it's a very difficult position, but being part of the league and part of the due process, I mean, the league, goes into this very detailed. You've got a court case that's going to come up, and I think due process is going to play out, and then a lot of decisions will come into play. I realize, it is delicate, and a lot of people want the team to take a stand, one way or the other. But the reality is that they have to follow protocol to, because there's contractual issues and legal issues at this stage. So, it's a delicate situation. I feel bad for everybody involved from. The alleged victim to whatever happened, with Terrence, to how the team's got to handle it. And I think a lot of fans, here's a kid who had just a tremendous amount of potential. And, I think everybody was excited to see what he was going to bring to the table this year. So, it's a tough one. I'm glad I don't have to be the one, to address it and deal with it. Because like I said, it's one of those where, honestly, no matter which way this goes, there's going to be a lot of reaction on both sides and a lot of different things happening. And it's very difficult because, like you said, it's a team that's taken a very strong stance on a lot of issues. And so it's very delicate. So, it's a tough call. And I know we'll find out a lot soon with the court case. I believe it's December 11th.
In conversation with Leo Routens on Writer's Block, I want to move to the other, to the other coast or the other conference, but Steph Curry did his media availability today, and look, we all know that the Warriors aren't going to have Klay Thompson. It does appear as if they will have Steph Curry, though. What are they going to be this year, Leo. And if I asked you to sort of, you know, put, if I asked you to look ahead to the Warriors 2 years down the road, or even next year, what do you think they're going to be? And are they going to be back challenging for a title soon?
100%. They're going to be back this year.
Okay.
You know, with or without Clay, I really like, one, Steve's a very good coach. Obviously, Steph Curry's a great player. They brought in some other assets that I think are going to contribute. We're going to find out, you know, the real Andrew Wiggins. We're going to find out, you know, James Wiseman, the rookie they got. He's got potential splashing all over the place and gives them something unique that they haven't really had in that a very active big that can influence a game at both ends. So, you know, I think this team, a lot of people just see Clay not being there. It's kind of like the Raptors last year, right? Okay, you don't have Kawhi. Okay, you're done. All right, forget about it. Don't worry about it. And look at the season the Raptors have. I think the Golden State Warriors are going to surprise a lot of people and be right in the mix this year. And a lot of it will be on how quickly, you know, certain players develop and fit in. If other players rise up, again, like an Andrew Wiggins. And, you know, when all that comes into play, we'll get a pretty good grasp of that. But I'm confident they're going to be really good. And then you're going to have a lot of pieces that are, you're going to kind of figure out where they fit and how they play. And when Klay Thompson comes back next year, they're going to be one of the strong teams to deal with. So, you know, I'm not losing faith or losing optimism about the Golden State Warriors. I think they're going to be fun to watch and a good team this year.
Leo, last one for me real quick. And that's the Brooklyn Nets. You know, the Raptors, you know, they're. I think they slot, like, you know, let's say if Milwaukee is the favorite in the East right now, or maybe the Nets are, you know, they're going to slot somewhere in like that playoff mix. Who, you know, depending on how, you know, how obviously you mentioned OG and Pascal do this year, but the Nets are like fascinating because like they literally, like, if they click, could absolutely be in the NBA Finals. I mean, I think you'd agree with me, Leo. Kevin Durant is that kind of difference maker. At the same time, like, chemistry-wise, with Kyrie, I mean, who knows what's going to happen with that team? I find them fascinating, and it relates obviously to the Raptors, of course, because the Raptors now got to deal with these guys.
So, yeah, I mean, I think they're one of the more challenging, if you want to call it that, teams in the entire NBA to look at and say, you know, where they're going to be. Because you're right, this is a team that could potentially get to the NBA Finals. This is a team that, you know, based on personalities, might have all kinds of issues and flame out at some point. I don't have anywhere near the confidence. Like you asked me about Golden State, and I'm going, I have no doubt they're going to be right back up there, even with the losses. But I think the Nets are going to be, like I said, they at times they might you know be shockingly good, and other times, you know, we don't know what we're going to get. And you also have a situation with, you know, Steve Nash in a new role as the coach with Mike D'Antoni in the mix there. You know that Steve's going to want to run and get out and play and a fast pace. But, you know, to be really good, we've seen that, you know, in that style of game, and we saw that with Golden State, you've got to be committed to the defensive end. You know, when Steve Kerr came in and Golden State bought in at the defensive end, that's when they took their game to the next level. And the question is going to be, you know, will the Nets be able to do that? Because they want to play fast. They want to play aggressive. Are they going to be able to bring it at the defensive end consistently? And then I think everybody wants to see how the personalities of Kyrie and Kevin Durant are going to match up. You know, one of the things that always impressed me with Kevin Durant, when he went to Golden State, you know, one of the things he said, when everybody was trying to figure out how to play together, he said, don't worry about me. I know how to play. You know, do your thing, and I'll figure it out. I was really impressed by that, and he did. And I think Kyrie is also the type of player that if you're playing with him, you got to say, okay, you do your thing, I'll figure out how to get mine. Because Kyrie is not easy to play with, all right? You do, a lot of times you're going to end up watching him play. Whereas Kevin Durant, as much of a big-time scorer as he is, a lot of it's out of the flow, out of the, you know, you play off your D, you play off you get a lot of movement. You're out and running. He's in the mix. He's getting things done. You're not standing there watching him create his own thing over and over. So I think the success of this team could really depend on how Kevin Durant adjusts to playing with Kyrie and then all the role players as well.
Leo, good stuff as always, my friend. Thank you for joining us. Stay safe, and it's great to be talking about some on-court stuff. Oh, can't wait to see sports back again, live and in person.
Yeah,
or at
I
least,
know.
If not in person,
I
at
know.
Least live.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to be talking hoops and like I said, to be somewhat normal, somewhat.
Yes.
So I'm excited, but stay safe, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. Be well. That is Leo Routens, our Raptors TV analyst on Sportsnet. December 2nd, Deitch, nobody's eliminated.
Everybody's still got a shot for the final.
It's like perpetual
except
spring training. Except for exactly. Except, you're right. I shouldn't say everybody. Nobody's eliminated. The Knicks are, I believe if you look at the vacant NBA standings right now, there's an asterisk beside the Knicks or a hashtag sign saying that the Knicks have been eliminated. The Knicks have been eliminated from the playoffs. Lindsey Jones is the Athletic's senior NFL writer. There will be NFL football today of a variety in about 25 minutes, as a matter of fact. The Baltimore Ravens playing ten players short, actually, Travis, if 46 players can dress. The Baltimore Ravens playing 10 players short in the COVID-19 Bowl against the Pittsburgh Steelers, who basically have been sitting there saying, guys, can we play the freaking game? We haven't done anything wrong here. And we'll talk to Lindsey Jones about it. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. I neglected to mention this when we were rolling through the list of roster moves made by the Pittsburgh Steelers. Or I'm sorry, made by the Baltimore Ravens. Pardon me. The Pittsburgh Steelers did put Maurkice Pouncey on the COVID list today. So there you go. The Steelers actually had a move to make as well. We've talked about it in the show. I don't know what I feel about it. I don't know how I feel about this game, to be honest. My initial reaction was to just kind of look at the Pittsburgh Steelers. And this is where I don't want anybody to get sick. And I certainly don't want anybody to have any long-term, have long-term ramifications from developing COVID-19. But at the same time, I'm finding myself having less and less patience with players who test positive. And I'm really finding myself, and I can't believe I say this, but I'm really finding myself feeling bad for teams like the Pittsburgh Steelers that have basically, for the most part, done things right and are kind of penalized by the stupidity of others. Lindsey Jones is senior NFL writer with The Athletic. And she joins us on Writer's Block. Lindsey, thank you for doing this, as always. You know we appreciate your time. We trust you are doing well. Look, the NHL has taken draft picks away. It's slapped financial penalties on teams. I'm one of those people that looks at what happened with the Denver Broncos this weekend. And I'm wondering, do you think that was the NFL maybe sending a message to teams that, we're kind of at the point now where, no more tough love. We're gonna drop the hammer here, and we're basically gonna make you play regardless of how many players develop COVID-19, especially if it appears it's as a result of stupidity on the part of your players or a lack of being careful.
Yeah, the thing with the Broncos, it wasn't about a number of cases, and it's never been about a number of cases. The NFL purposely did not set a threshold of how many positive cases it would take to trigger a shutdown or a cancellation or anything like that, which is different than college football. Well, college football kind of has a roster limit where you have to have a certain number of guys available. The NFL believes that through the rule changes that they put in place this summer with expanded practice squad and flexibility to pull guys up and down, that all teams should be able to kind of stay within those limits. The thing with the Broncos was that it was not about positive cases. They had a couple isolated cases, but it was a contact tracing all the rest of the quarterbacks weren't available because they messed up. And if anything, it was, and this was how I understood it on Saturday when the guys were first ruled out and has not changed from then through now. And we actually just got off the phone, a conference call with Roger Goodell and a couple other league executives about an hour ago and, you know, kind of continued to reinforce that, that they're just, they're saying these are our protocols and you can follow them. And if you don't follow them, then here's how we're going to proceed. And they're not really interested in making exceptions and kind of getting into this case by case, figuring out, okay, well, you don't have your quarterbacks or you don't have your running backs or your wide receivers. And really what it, the result is that this is a season that, you know, it's just not going to be fair. And if you are coming into each week with the expectation of fairness and competitive balance, which is really what the league tries to pride itself on, right? But if you come in expecting that that standard is here this year in this very weird COVID pandemic year, you're going to be disappointed because it's just not that way. And there's a whole lot of teams. I mean, I live in Denver. I was at that Broncos game on Sunday, talking to a lot of people within that organization. And, you know, their fans are certainly all up in my Twitter mentions. And there's a lot of people in Denver who feel like persecuted by this and who feel like the league was, you know, using them to make an example. And if they had been, you know, the Patriots or the Kansas City Chiefs or, you know, maybe a more winning organization right now, that they wouldn't have done this. But I think you could look at the Steelers, and you did just mention the Steelers, who they're 10-0. They have one of the most, you know, stable and respected franchises in the league and respected ownership. And, you know, they've been jerked around this season more than anybody. But at the same time, they also haven't been immune from all of this. Like you just mentioned, you know, coming out of the break, they put Marquise Pouncey, their all-pro center, on the COVID list this week. James Conner, their starting running back, he's on the list this week. They had coaches. So there's really nobody who's immune to this. I don't think there's any team that can kind of throw stones right now, because this is impacting everybody in the NFL, and it's really messy, and I don't think there's any great solution right now.
Really need some we need less Americans, Lindsay, to be believing in conspiracy theories against fan bases and otherwise.
I think you just said less Americans, and that would probably be fine too.
What do you guys say that? It's got the two Americans on here talking.
I know. It's beautiful.
It's been a rough couple of years, all right?
Yeah, well, that's
we got
true.
A better,
that's true.
As I tell everybody at the Athletic, Lindsay, there's a free room upstairs for you. Just help out watching the kids, and it's a deal.
You don't want to take up that offer, Lindsay. You don't want to take up that offer.
I've got one of my own. We could do some communal.
Yeah, trust me. Listen, at this point, any other kid sounds good. I'm not going to lie. one of the things that's interesting is, and you talked about this in terms of, you know, the NFL really has prided itself on competitiveness, competitive balance and parity, and that's sort of what the league makes its bones on. So Blair and I were talking about this scenario earlier this week, which is really fascinating to me. I obviously hope it doesn't happen, but it could happen. I think their league's going to blow through the regular season. They're going to figure out ways to get through as we're doing with this crazy Wednesday afternoon game. But here's my but for you as someone who covers the league nationally. Do you think the league would really stand on the principle that they've now set if, let's say, it's the AFC championship game and Patrick Mahomes tests positive for COVID-19 or something where a star player, a game-changing star player in the conference championship or the Super Bowl test positive? Do you think they base it on this precedent, or do you think they in real time would change things up, given that that would be, let's be honest, man, that would be some kind of decision if they decide to play without a star like that?
Yeah, I mean, look, nobody wants to see Chad Henne in the AFC championship game, except, I mean, and you know what, Chad Henne's mom probably doesn't even want to see Chad Henne in the AFC championship game. So that is the big question. And we, you know, we did have this conference call just a little bit ago with NFL executives, including Goodell. And he was asked a lot of versions of that question about, now that this has happened, what are these offseason or postseason contingency plans? And they wouldn't commit to anything. He really dumped cold water on the idea of like an entire playoff bubble. You know, he said, that a bubble, the way that the media focuses on it, is not in the cards for the NFL. And I think that's largely referring to like an NBA or NHL style bubble, where it's all the teams in one location, you know, basically nobody in and out other than like service workers. Broadcast is in, everybody. That does not seem to be like something that the NFL will consider. I think the thing that is viable and that the NFL is going to look very strongly at is mandating that all of the teams actually create their own like local bubbles for the postseason. So that's, you know, everybody, all players, coaches, staff, everybody is within their own hotel situation. They only leave, they leave together as a group. They're in and out. They're all tested, make sure they're negative before they're embubbled in their team hotel. They would have to travel for games, which makes this not a true bubble. And that's what they, you know, they always keep coming back to whenever you say, well, why haven't you done a bubble? And they're like, well, it's not a bubble if you're still traveling, if there's still people in and out. But I think because the majority of the cases, I mean, the vast overwhelming majority of, you know, now there's something at 400 and, you know, well over 400 cases now in the NFL since August 1st. The vast majority of those cases have come from community spread and come from outside the building. You know, with the exception of the Titans and the Ravens, there hasn't been mass spread within these buildings. So they, if they can keep it from coming into their building, I think they can get through the postseason. But it's a really interesting question. And yeah, I mean, it's the NFL's nightmare scenario. It was embarrassing enough to have to, you know, play that game on Sunday and put that sort of product on the field with, you know, poor Kendall Hinton, you know, really nice kid, but impossible situation. The NFL cannot risk having that in one of its marquee postseason games.
You know, one of the things I found interesting, Lindsay, just reading a couple of minutes ago, we had Amy Trask on earlier this week, and I asked her, I thought back to an interview Bruce Arians did in the summer, which I squirreled away because I thought it was, to me, it was a no-brainer. But he, you know, mused about the possibility of effectively isolating a quarterback all year. And, you know, Amy said you can expect to see more teams do that, especially teams that are, you know, in playoff contention. And I just noticed today that Vic Fangio has said that Blake Bortles, his exposure to teammates is going to be limited. He's not going to come to the team's facility for midweek activities. He's going to spend less time at the facility, and look, you can't tell the guy to stay away, and we'll call you when we need you. But effectively, it seems as if what Vic Fangio is trying to do is just isolate as much as you can that one quarterback, so that you don't find yourself in that position. Why doesn't every NFL team do that from this point forward? It would just make sense.
Yeah, and there are more teams that are doing it. So the Broncos are going to do it with Blake Bortles. The Bills have been doing it with Jake Fromm, their rookie draft pick out of Georgia. He has been largely isolated. He doesn't do meetings and practices with the team. He, you know, does everything virtually and then goes and does his own kind of workout by himself at the facility. There have been other teams. You know, the Eagles were doing it for a while, but under a completely different circumstances, where Josh McCown was on their practice squad but was living in Texas, which I don't, that wouldn't have worked. I mean, if they had had a, your guys are ruled out on Saturday, you could not have gotten them, him there from Texas to Philadelphia and pass, you know, pass tests and stuff to get in. But we are going to see more teams do it. I believe the New York Giants just signed another quarterback that they're going to try to isolate. So we are seeing it now. I don't think they're going to mandate it, but it is something that now more teams are considering because they've seen the worst case scenario. They've seen now what has happened. And, you know, I was like you when Bruce Arians first said it this summer, we kind of like chuckled like, oh, quarantine quarterback, but you can't be caught in that situation now. And, you know, the NFL is going to make you play through it. So you better have some sort of contingency plan.
Lindsay, this game, maybe this game has started already, but this game is about to start. What are you looking for today? I think if you're the NFL, you are looking probably for a clean, quick game, competitive. I'm not sure it will be, but what are you
looking
for?
Steelers win, let's be honest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just given, Jeff and I talked about this, I mean, just given what's out there, like, I think we could be looking at a Saints-Broncos situation, but what do you expect today?
Yeah, well, in terms of what I actually can watch, I'm trying to figure out how I can actually watch it right now because there's a dispute between NBC and DirecTV in my local area, and I can't actually see the game on my television right now. But I am very much, that's another story for you later, Richard, probably. but, you know,
check,
I
check
I
your inbox, Lindsay. I might be able to send you a secret code.
That's good to know. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's going to be quite as dramatic as the Broncos situation because, you know, RG3, while not a, you know, he hasn't been a great quarterback in a while, he at least is a viable backup quarterback. So it's from at least that standpoint. But they have 9 starters that they're going to be without this week. They have a lot of new guys that are coming up off the practice squad, you know, at all parts of the roster, you know, offensive line, defensive line, linebacker, DB. I mean, all across their roster, they're having to play guys that haven't played much in the NFL, maybe haven't played in the NFL at all, certainly haven't played or practiced together. They went through a walkthrough and one kind of light practice together. So, you know, I would expect that, you know, this should be a game that the Steelers win. It shouldn't be too significant of a challenge. I will say the Steelers tend to play down to their competition, and they haven't been blowing teams out. They had to come back and beat the Cowboys last month when the Cowboys were playing with a backup quarterback. Garrett Gilbert, you know, almost beat them. So it's not like, you know, and the Steelers, like we kind of mentioned, they have some of their own issues too. James Conner isn't in this game. Marquise Pouncey isn't in this game because of COVID issues. But yeah, I think, you know, I think it's not going to be nearly the competitive game that we would have gotten had this game happened, you know, in week 18 or had happened without some sort of outbreak.
Lindsay, good stuff as always. Thank you so much for joining us. Check your inbox. I'm sure Deitch has figured out a way for you to watch the game.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Take care.
Thanks, guys.
All righty. That is Lindsay Jones, senior NFL writer with The Athletic, one of the really good writers at The Athletic. There's a lot there, but Lindsay Jones' NFL coverage is top-notch. Deitch, have you sent her that secret code?
Yeah, I mean,
that's kind of a cool story for you, isn't it? That's kind of a cool story for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I do work for a major communication company. We shouldn't be sending that stuff. But, yeah, I mean, listen, Jeff, there's a lot of times there are disputes locally where you know, cable carriers and content providers sort of have these battles. Usually, though, they get settled before a game of note. The thing with
this
Lindsay
game of
is
note was not supposed to was not supposed
well. It's
to
like she's in Denver. Yeah, she's in Denver, and this is not a local game for her. So, like, there's not as much incentive. Like, if you know what I mean, if you were in Pittsburgh or Baltimore, you know, somebody usually blinks because they don't want angry customers. That's the difference here.
Right. Interesting. LeBron James has said that, or at least according to reports, has said that he's ready to sign a 2-year, $85 million extension. That keeps him with the Lakers through 2023, which should be enough to get a couple of more championships. It also happens to line him up with the entry into the NBA of his son, Bronny. And who knows, it may allow the Lakers to get Giannis Antetokounmpo as well. See how nicely it's all going to fit together. Dan Wojcicki is a national basketball writer with the LA Times. He'll have LeBron James to kick around for another couple of years. Not that he would do it, but you know what I mean. He'll join us next. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. The 25th anniversary of Patrick Waugh's last game with the Montreal Canadiens. That was a memorable, it's one of the sort of memorable yet not often cited great moments in Canadian sports history. I don't know if you'd call it great moments, significant moments in Canadian sports history. And, of course, Patrick Waugh, 4 days later, was traded to the Colorado Avalanche, and we all know how that ended up. And it was kind of odd because Patrick Waugh went from the Montreal Canadiens to the Colorado Avalanche, who were, of course, the former Quebec Nordique. And the idea of Patrick Waugh playing for the Nordique in Quebec would make your head explode. Anyhow, we'll talk to Brian Burke about what he remembers about that particular day, that particular trade, and its significance. And we'll also take a look on the wait for agreements to be made about the 2021 NHL season. It's been reported now that LeBron James has accepted a 2-year, $85 million contract extension that will keep him with the Lakers through 2023, which gives him a chance to win a couple more titles, get Giannis Antetokounmpo to the Lakers, and who knows, maybe somehow arrange to play alongside his son, Bronny, who would likely enter the NBA around then. Now, I may be guilty of sort of looking too far down the road. Let's bring in Dan Wojcicki, the national basketball writer with the LA Times. Am I guilty of like putting two and two and two together and coming up with six?
I mean, let's wait for him to get his driver's license first, guys. I think like that's step number one, right? Is can Brownie parallel park, and then and handle those tough 2-point turns in Brentwood. And if he can do that, then maybe we can talk about the NBA.
Dan, listen. if Brownie ever needs to drive himself anywhere, right? If he does not have a driver to his high school grad, something is seriously wrong.
I don't think they still teach home ec, but if they did, like, he could just be like, nah, I'm good. It's covered.
Seriously,
I think what is the significance? Probably, by the way.
Yeah, what's the significance of this? Beyond LeBron's going to be there till 2023.
I mean, look, right? I think to me, my sort of, like, and we'll see how this domino kind of falls with Anthony Davis's negotiations with the Lakers. And, you know, I would not be surprised to see Anthony Davis kind of end up on the same timeline. You know, that seems like that is a popular way to go if you're superstars, especially two that like each other, that are represented by the same agency, that are so intertwined like LeBron and Anthony Davis are. To me, the thing that I'm drawn to most when I saw this, and as I've kind of thought about it throughout the day and as I kind of try to figure out what I'm going to write about sort of this as a whole, is what it does actually kind of ensure – or not ensure, but gives the Lakers a pretty good shot at, is another just sort of all-time iconic NBA moment. And that is, you know, we might see LeBron James pass Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in a Laker jersey, you know, where that torch may move, again, from an all-time Laker great to someone who then at that point had spent, you know, 5 years with the Lakers, a quarter of his career, you know, also kind of cementing his place in Laker history. And it's just kind of what when I think about sort of these iconic moments in NBA history, you want to see them happen on the biggest stages with the highest stakes. And it's, you know, LeBron James doing it for the Los Angeles Lakers, you know, taking the record from, you know, the greatest scorer in NBA history, who also, by the way, was an NBA champion with the Los Angeles Lakers. Like, that just feels like a special moment. And look, it'd be special if he was playing for the Memphis Grizzlies. It would be special if he was playing for the Detroit Pistons. But you know, the fact that it's the Lakers adds a certain level of kind of gravitas to the moment. And that's what it strikes me as, right? Like, yes, it's a commitment to the organization. It's a commitment. It signs off on Rob Pelinka. It signs off on Jeannie Buss, validates their efforts. But, I mean, look, so did the title. Right. It was hard to imagine LeBron going shopping for a new home, you know, next year, you know, too, to be totally honest. Like, I don't think anybody really thought that he'd be leaving in free agency. But to me, that's what it sets up. Right. Is that iconic moment can now happen in purple and gold. And that's a huge deal.
What, you know, the Lakers and the Clippers have been pretty fascinating in the offseason, given who they signed, and perhaps more interesting, sort of like who is in a better and who's in a better position. Where do you think the Lakers are in terms of after their signings?
You know, it's interesting. I think they addressed. You know, it's hard to look in the NBA champion and say they've had problems that they needed to fix, but I think the Lakers had some things that they needed to address. You know, they needed more playmaking. And, you know, they go out and get Dennis Schroeder. They needed more bench scoring, so they go get Montrezl Harrell, the sixth man of the year. You know, I think in adding Marc Gasol, you add somebody who's just so solid and trustworthy in a way that, you know, and JaVale McGee was fine, but, you know, brings a certain, definitely a different level of, like, defensive acumen to your team, a different level of passing and again, playmaking. Those things are all great. But it's weird after watching, you know, you think about the guys who left, and you think about the impacts they made on that team. You think about what Dwight Howard meant to the Lakers and Rajon Rondo in the playoffs. And, you know, it's funny, and Danny Green as being kind of a stabilizing hand all year. It's, you know, they did sacrifice a lot of continuity, and that team had tremendous chemistry last year. And, you know, it's hard. Chemistry is tricky, you know. Sometimes it's obvious that it's not going to work, and we'll get to the Clippers in a second. And I think sometimes it's a little harder to know. And I think the Lakers gambled in getting younger and getting more talented. Like, they did add some disruptors. It's, you know, Dennis Schroeder hasn't always been viewed as the world's greatest teammate. That happened in Atlanta a little bit. And now, obviously, he's a more mature player now with different stakes. But, look, that's there. And he's a guy who wants to shoot and wants to score. Montrezl Harrell was kind of a part of this Clippers mess. You know, was he the problem, or was he just sort of caught up in it? Like, we'll find out. You know, I think it was an interesting gamble, but very rarely do NBA championship teams come out of an off season and somehow get younger and more talented. And I say kudos to the Lakers for going for it in that way, for kind of recognizing that maybe they weren't good enough as constructed to repeat, that they needed to get better. The Clippers, on the other hand, I think obviously had some real soul searching to do. I mean, the biggest change, look, obviously Serge Ibaka is a terrific player. I think he's a big upgrade. But the biggest change, right, is that Doc Rivers isn't there anymore, that you do have a new voice. You have Tyronn Lue, and hopefully I think the Clippers are looking for him to kind of maybe be a little bit better with their superstars and get them to embrace their teammates more and kind of bridge some of those culture gaps that existed on that team last year and get everybody on the same page and you know, tell the stars that, yeah, you're stars and you're going to get special treatment and you're going to have things your way. But at the same time, hey, guys, you're going to have to, you know, embrace your other teammates. And then likewise, the stars are going to, if you're a role player, like, you can't be surprised when Kawhi Leonard has a private training space or when Paul George has a preferred security guard. They're superstars. It's the NBA. Look around. This happens everywhere.
You know, it's interesting. I just wanted a quick follow-up on that because, you know, The Athletic today ran a pretty big story that,
yep.
You know, the sort of the highlight of this is basically like the Clippers are like a 12 plus 2, 13 plus 2, you know, two guys, Paul George and Kawhi Leonard, yeah. And then there's the rest of the team. There were some interesting quotes in there, Dan. I just wondered, like, sort of your take on this and that, like, you know, talent can take care of a lot of stuff, but it doesn't necessarily take care of chemistry. And the only thing I would say is, do you think there is any lingering resentment of those two guys as we start the year, or because they are so talented, which they, I would add, they're better now with Serge, that ultimately talent sort of can overcome jealousies and guys getting special treatment, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, I read Jovan Buha's story in The Athletic. It's a very, it's a good read. I think to me, like I was trying to point out, I just think it's all just such a two-way street, right? Like, on one hand, you do have, you know, quote-unquote, sort of like diva behavior or special treatment by the team superstars, right? And that is problematic. And talent does overcome that, right? Like, you do, you know, Michael Jordan, I mean, we spent a summer, you know, or I guess it was, or a spring, watching Michael Jordan berate teammates and gamble with security guards instead of hang out with his teammates. Right. Like, I mean, like we watched that and we adored it. And like, this isn't new per se. Right. You know, Kobe Bryant kind of famously not knowing who Smush Parker was, stuff like that. Right. Like, this stuff happens with stars. And it's not ideal. It doesn't happen with all stars, but it does happen. And I think to me, what happened with the Clippers last year, and this is a question I think I even asked on Media Day, wasn't to Doc Rivers because he's talking to me today, but to maybe Patrick Beverley or someone like that, was like, you know, the team before that had such an underdog mentality, right? Like, they kind of fought like they played like somebody was like trying to drown them, and they were, you know, they were kicking and punching and, you know, like couldn't be pinned down, right? Like, that was sort of the frenetic energy that team had the year before. Well, like, You don't really get to have that same mindset when you walk out of the court every night. You probably have the two most talented guys, right? Or, Danny, or certainly, like, it's hard to do that.
Danny, thanks so much for doing this, man. Great insight, as always. Stay safe.
All right, take care, guys.
Dan Wojcik is a national basketball writer with the LA Times. Brian Burke is back from a very, 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 very brief hiatus. He is, of course, our Hockey Central analyst, also author with Stephen Brunt of Burke's Law, A Life in Hockey. Always look forward to talking. Brian Burke will join us next. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt, and Richard Deitch on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Reminder that our friends at Jiffy's have helped clean out our prize closet and create mystery boxes that contain autographed jerseys, photos, and much, much more that we want you to win. Now, the next keyword you need to text to 590-590 to enter is leaves. That's LEAVES. Text LEAVES to 590-590 right now, along with your first and last name and city. Then tune in tomorrow morning during leadoff and call in if you hear your name announced to qualify and immediately win a $100 gift card to spend at Jiffy. Fast and reliable home maintenance for less. Your next keyword will be announced after 5 p.m. during Tim and Sid. You can find full contest details at sportsnet.ca/590. Tonight on Sportsnet, the Detroit Red Wings game against the Montreal Canadiens on December 2nd, 1995 will be replayed. This was Patrick Roy's final game with the Canadiens. I mentioned it's not one of the greatest moments in Canadian sports history, but it was hugely significant. Patrick Roy letting in 5 goals in the first period, taking the net for the second period, giving up a couple more, and obviously looking over at the Canadiens bench at head coach Mario Tremblay to be pulled out of the game, mercifully. It didn't come until he let in 9 goals. At that point, Patrick Roy went to the bench, walked past Mario Tremblay, puts his stuff down on the bench, walks past him again, or behind him, goes to team president Ronald Corey, who was sitting behind the bench, and told him he'd played his last game for the Canadiens. And he had. He was traded to the Colorado Avalanche, and everybody in Montreal and Colorado, indeed the NHL, knows where it went from there. As I mentioned, I was working in Montreal at the time covering baseball. I seldom have I been left speechless by an event. I remember seeing that happen. And I knowing a little bit about what had gone on in the background, just a little bit, I was still surprised to see Patrick Roy so boldly and so brazenly go over to Ronald Corey. Brian Burke is Sportsnet's Hockey Central analyst. He's also author with Stephen Brunt of Burke's Law, Life in Hockey. He joins us in Writer's Block. Brian, what do you remember most about that game, about Patrick coming out of the game, walking over to Corey and subsequent trade? Because it did send shockwaves around the NHL, didn't it?
Yeah, I was working at the league then. I remember that game distinctly. I was watching it, and you know, every goalie, especially star goalies, but every starting goalie that plays the majority of games has a little cue that he can give the trainer, you know, get me out of here. And I'm watching the game. I was watching with Dave Norris, as I recall. I remember saying out loud several times, why don't they yank him? Like, you don't ever want to embarrass a star player like that. And usually he'll let you know. Sometimes they do want to stay in there. Sometimes, during a timeout, you send your captain out and say, what do you want to do? And sometimes the guy will say, look, I need to work. I'm rusty. And even though I'm getting lit up, I want to stay in. But they should have yanked him. And like I say, everyone's got a cue. They say to the trainer, they shrug or something. And the trainer goes to coach and says, Patrick wants out. So I'm watching the game saying out loud, why are they leaving him in there to get killed like this?
Brian, I heard you today on Hockey Central. It was a great show. Actually, I enjoyed you guys today. And you guys talked a lot about this. And one of the things that was interesting to me when you discussed it is Merrick asked you about trading a star player and sort of the calculations. And, you know, the old adage that whoever gets the best player in the deal wins the deal. And so the corollary to Patrick Roy is you had to trade Pavel Bure. And I wonder just now with a bit of hindsight, how do you approach like that kind of thing today? And you know, trading that transcended a star, and when you look back on the Bure deal, how do you feel about it?
Well, it wasn't a good deal. I mean, I said that at the time. I told my owner, I said, look, it's a distressed asset. So you got a guy who's holding out. No one's going to pay full value for that. I think Brian Murray skinned me on that deal, but I didn't like it. None of our guys liked it. You know, Brett Hedekin was in that deal. He didn't talk to me for 2 years. He was so mad I traded him. So as Hedekin and Bure go to Florida, we got Eddie Jovanovski, who I loved having as a player. Got a first-round pick. You got Mike Brown, Dave Gagne, we didn't get, you know, Pavel scored 50 goals twice for Florida the next two seasons. I mean, we did not get full value. And I told my owner at the time, I told Mr. McKay, I said, look, this is not a good value. This is not a good trade. But we're going to miss the playoffs if I don't do something and get some assets back in the lineup. We're going to miss the playoffs by a mile. And this is the best we can do. I didn't get anything like even close to that offer from any other team. So we took the best deal we could make, knowing it wasn't enough. And history will not look back on that deal kindly for me. But that's all we could get.
You know, you're the perfect person to ask this, because I've often wondered, and I've never had a chance to ask Ronald Corey this, and or frankly Patrick, but as someone who's had to make a decision about trading a player, I have often wondered what would have happened had Ronald Corey not been sitting behind the bench. What if Ronald Corey was, I don't know, in the press box or up in a private suite or something like that, and would Montreal's position have been strengthened? I mean, I'm playing this game, but it's funny because I can remember folks in the Montreal media at the time talking about Ronald Corey sitting behind the bench and how, you know what, this is probably not a good thing that the club president can be that close to the players. And I'm just kind of wondering how you feel about that, Brian, because, look, I know you've always walked that line between being the manager of the hockey team but also a guy that the players need access to, right? I mean, there's a certain line there. How did you feel about that? And I don't know. Maybe it's just a stupid thought exercise on my part, but it's always kind of intrigued me. What if cooler heads had prevailed?
I don't think it's a stupid thought at all. Everyone in hockey was talking about that. And before it happened, like, the potential for something like that to happen, and when you're sitting right there, is larger than life. Like, it's almost a guarantee you're going to have a scene at some point with some player. Now, it turns out it's your superstar goalie. Now, to me, I remember thinking, I said this to Gary Bettman, he said, what's going to happen? I said, I'd get them all in a room and get a case of beer and sort it out. And just say, okay, Patrick, I didn't take you out because I was waiting for you to give me a sign. Like, explain why you got embarrassed. And there's probably a good explanation. And so the coach says, look, I kept looking at you. You didn't shrug. You didn't give me any sign. I asked the trainer. We got after the first period, you're down 4-0. I asked you if you wanted to come out, and you said no. So I would never embarrass you on purpose. I'm sorry it happened. Let's move on. You just put it behind you. There's a lot you can sort out over a case of beer. It's an unbelievable drug for sorting out problems. And I thought they could have put that behind them, but they didn't. And he went on, and obviously Colorado picked up a couple of cups, and Montreal hasn't won since 93. That's the last Canadian team that won.
Brian, I want to switch to this year. You spoke about this on Hockey Central, but there's still time for the players and the owners in the league to figure this out. But not as much time as there used to be. We're seeing other sports start. You've always said on the station, you've said on this show many times, that don't give the public reason to watch the NBA. Don't give the public reason to spend their dollars elsewhere. The players have been steadfast so far in terms of not agreeing at this point to take far less money this year. Where does your optimism or pessimism stand at this point?
Well, I've said all along that we're going to play, but the players are going to have to accept some grim reality of where we are in terms of the business. I mean, in the NHL, gate receipts drive about 50% of the revenue for a team, which is a far higher percentage than any other sport. And most of their revenues come from broadcast deals, television deals. Here, we've lost half the revenue base of our business, plus some. So if I have a rink board at Scotiabank Arena, I expect 20,000 people to see it every night. Now, I'm not going to get that. It's going to be socially distant seating. I'm not paying full price for that rink board. So it's more, not just the tickets lost, the concessions, the beer, the parking, all gone. Horrible, horrible hit. And I said at the time, when they made this deal in March, they capped escrow at 20%. And I said, it's going to be 50%. Like, it's capping at 20, it's fine, but it's going to be 50%, 40% at least, and maybe 50%. The fact is, I don't understand these. The league grossly underestimated the damage to the business. So they're talking about 6% or 8% cap on escrow in years two and three. That's not realistic. I mean, unless the vaccine gets distributed and we have full buildings, but you got unemployment at, you know, like soaring in certain states in the U.S. We all think it's going to come back in Canada. I really believe that. No problem. But I'm not so sure it's going to come back quickly in the states in some of our markets. So I think the players are looking at, they're talking about such small percentages when 50% of the revenue is lost. I don't understand why the owners are tiptoeing around this issue. Go to the players and say, you're going to take 50 cents on the dollar or we're not going to play. And the owners have the right under the MOU to not play. I had a GM tell me, sit across from me and tell me, if we play, this is 2 weeks ago, if we play, it costs me $60 million. If we don't play, it costs me $15. So we have to get the ice back on the game back on the ice. The players are going to have to take a huge hit. The percentages they're talking about just don't add up. They don't make any sense. I said this in March. As soon as the pause happened, I said, we're looking at a 40% wage rollback. That's what we're looking at. I don't know why we're tiptoeing around talking about 6% escrow next year. It's going to be more than that.
Yeah, you know, your point is really well made, Brian. I wonder why it just wasn't presented to the players openly as soon as the Stanley Cup was done. Guys, this is where we are. You've got a month to mull this over, 6 weeks to mull this over, but this is where we are. And I don't know, maybe the non-negotiations or whatever, they were started at that point. But I'm kind of with you. You know, and there are people out there going to roll their eyes and go, yeah, accountants, tricks, yada, yada, et cetera, and no team's really going to lose money. I think in this case, if you're open with your players... I agree with you, man. This is where we are. This is where we are.
You're talking about a once in a century happening.
Correct.
And I don't think there's realistic expectations on the players' parts at all on what's happened here. And what I'm saying is we got to play. And if that's at 50 cents on the dollar, take the 50 cents on the dollar. Now, they're talking about deferral. If they can somehow borrow against the new U.S. television deal and give the players back some of this money, I'm fine with that. I'm fine with anything. Mm-hmm. But for now, what I would say to players is, you're coming back at 50 cents on the dollar, or we're not going to play. We are not paying more than our this is not a collective bargaining agreement negotiation. They have a deal. It's a 50-50 partnership. And half of our revenues have disappeared. We got to save the other half or whatever part we can. You guys take a pay cut. And then if you want to keep the cap flat and recover some of this money as deferred money down the road, fine with me. That means that a different generation of players is actually going to pay for this. So you have deferred money and you say, okay, we'll defer the money. We'll take it out of the new U.S. deal. That'll mean the cap will be flat for 7 years. And this generation of players is going to be paid by a different group of players. So it's not nice. It's not fun. You talk to anyone who owns a restaurant in Toronto and ask how much fun they're having right now.
We've kind of operated under the assumption that the U.S.-Canada border is a big deal. And it is a big deal. Opening it is a huge deal. It's one of the reason the Raptors are in Tampa. But, you know, you look around Canada, and I understand that the idea is out there about a Canadian division. Brian, I look at numbers in Manitoba. I mean, Manitoba just announced today that kids are going to be schooling from home after Christmas. Manitoba's case numbers are just, I mean, they scare the hell out of me as someone who's still got family there. Alberta's having a hard time. Ontario and Quebec are having a hard time. Is this whole idea of a Canadian division in jeopardy right now? And maybe we don't know that? Or maybe not thinking about it enough?
No, I think it's going to happen. And it's because of the quarantine. I don't think it has anything to do with case numbers. I think it's the fact that any U.S. team that flies in has to quarantine for 14 days. So they can't travel across the border. It's just not possible. You're going to have players, and this is why they have to make a deal with some urgency here. Players are going to come back. The players have told the league they do not want to mess around with Christmas at all. So they're not coming back till, say, 27th, 28th, 29th. So you fly back from Europe, Americans that play for Canadian teams go back to Canada, you quarantine for 14 days, now it's January 15th. Training camp opens 2 weeks, February 1st, you start playing games. So it's a quarantine. It's not the case numbers, which are alarming. And they face it. Everyone's doing a poor job with this disease right now. Like, Canada did a great job, and there's some fatigue right now, and we're letting up. We're taking our foot off the gas, and it's not helping. And until a vaccine's developed and distributed, it's not going to change. We need to be smarter and more disciplined.
I could not agree more. That's well said, Brian. One thing for me on the potential for a Canadian division. You know, no matter what, you're hurt, obviously, with gate receipts. That's just going to be the inevitability of this league. I do think, Brian, at least in Canada, I can't say this for the States, but I can say for Canada, I think if the Canadian division does happen, you will get a little bit of a boost in terms of television viewership.
And oh, absolutely.
I think just interest, because it's such a unique novelty that I think the Canadian hockey audience would really embrace this for a singular year.
I agree. I think it's exciting. Plus, you're going to play a compacted schedule. Like, you're going to play back-to-backs. Like, the Calgary Flames aren't going to come to Toronto and play one game. They're going to come and play two games. And my theory on back-to-backs was I always dressed the right lineup on the first game to guarantee a sellout on the second game. So made sure there was a lot of rough stuff in the first night, and then you sell out the second night. So to me, like, I think it's really exciting. Like, you mentioned the Calgary Flames come here and play twice back-to-back. It'd be awesome. Like, I can't wait for the season to start. Now, they'll play each other. Even if they play a 60-game schedule, they play all the other teams 10 times, roughly. Or there's some divisional aspect of it, maybe 8 times. But it'll be like the old 16 league. Like, people forget, back when there were 6 teams in the NHL, they played each other like 10 times. And these rivalries that developed were very bitter and very real. Like, I can't wait to see what this will look like.
Berkey, really good of you to do this, as always. Great to have
you
back.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you.
Take care. That is Brian Berk, Hockey Central, and
you're almost, you know, Jeff,
Hockey Central.
I didn't mean to jump you. I was going to say, like, it's
go ahead.
Almost a little, if the Canadian division happens, which I think it seems like it clearly will, I'm going to have a little bit of a baseball-like feel to the NHL season, you know, with, like, it won't be like a weekend series because they probably will only do back-to-backs, but like hockey will have a very much like a baseball feel for the first time perhaps in its history, at least in this division.
Yeah, I understand why the Canadian division has such an appeal for people. I understand why logistically it would make sense to do it. I wonder, though, about, and I understand what Brian was saying, but I just wonder about, you know, if businesses are closed in Winnipeg, if businesses are closed in Toronto, you know, if you've already told the Raptors you can't play here, understanding there's a cross-border issue, I don't know if I really want NHL players going from province to province. I think there are people, let me rephrase it. I think the let's hide under our beds people are gonna have an issue with that. I don't know how I feel about it. I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, he's a hockey fan. I like the American teams, man. I mean, I just do. I'm gonna miss not seeing the Blackhawks come here. I am. That's the game I love to go watch. That's where I'm a fan. I can go and watch the Hawks play. I'm a fan. I can go see the Jets play. I can still see the Jets play. But I go see the Hawks play, I'm a fan. And I kind of miss that a bit, but I do get Brian's point, Rich. I think he's dead on. I don't think you tiptoe around this. I think you, and maybe what we're seeing today is Gary kind of moving that way by saying, no, this isn't a renegotiation. We're not renegotiating the CBA. The CBA stands. This is a crisis situation. Maybe that's kind of the beginning of that move.
Well, they gotta. The other thing too is they really got to play this year because they need to get to They need to get to the NBC U.S. domestic. Like, they need that U.S. domestic deal to be completed so they can renegotiate the new deal.
Look, the
so
last
you don't
thing
give up the season.
Yes,
because, you know,
the
then that big money's not coming for another year.
Right, and the last thing you want to have happen, and I certainly don't want to get ahead of myself, but the last thing you don't want to have happen is you aren't playing and suddenly a vaccine is available in February and March, and society's opening up a little bit, right? Maybe
right.
It's not going to open completely, but you know what I'm saying. People have taken a breath. The vaccine is out there. And now if you don't want to be that league that isn't playing. You just don't.
Yeah.
Because by that point,
And I'll just say real quick, the reason why I think the Canadian division actually is really a can't-miss thing is, at the end of the day, countries are parochial. We see this with the Olympics. And you I think Canadians will really sort of wrap their head around the idea of Canadian teams playing Canadian teams over and over again in a singular season. Like, I know what you're saying when it comes to the Blackhawks. I just think you're an anomaly. Like, I don't think there's a ton of people who are like, I love the competition with the Sabres, but, like, I think...
No, you're probably right.
Just think of the marketing possibilities for Rogers. Like, there's a lot that can be done with a Canada versus Canada kind of season. I'm not saying do it forever, but I think it does give you something in a really tough time to market the game.
8 o'clock tonight is the deadline for arbitration eligible players to be given contracts or tendered contracts, I should say. We already know some names that were rumored to be out there will not be. Gary Sanchez, we're led to believe, will be offered a contract. Thus, he will not be a free agent. We're led to believe that Tommy Pham of the Padres will likely be offered a contract. John Gray of the Rockies. But there are some names out there. There are more and more names, it seems, with every passing moment, reports that more and more guys will not be offered contracts, which is just going to blow this free agent pool open completely. It's not going to impact. You're still going to have your top tier of free agents. But I think what it does do is it puts teams in a position where they can make a quicker decision on whether or not they're truly in on the top tier guys. And it gives them a lot of options if they decide to lower their sights a little bit. And maybe more than any other team in the market right now, the Toronto Blue Jays are in that position. Mark Carrig is senior baseball writer at The Athletic. He'll join us next. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Yesterday, the Salvation Army Canada and Rogers Communications announced a new and innovative touchless digital option that allows you to safely donate to the Christmas Kettles campaign using a credit card or smartphone. You can find information and also donate virtually through the Salvation Army Canada website. That is at salvationarmy.ca. John Paul Morosi and Elliot Friedman will join Tim and Sid from 5 to 7. Arash Madani joins us at 4:50 to get us set for that show. And Richard, maybe we can take Arash's temperature, so to speak, about this Raptors not playing on Christmas Day thing.
Ugh, it's a layup for him.
How do you think he feels about it? Because he's going to have to deal with Sid. You know Sid's going to be full of outrage. Well, he's been basically quiet on Twitter since then. Maybe saving
warming up
all
for the
powder
show
to take a shot at me. I don't know. 8 o'clock tonight is the non-tender deadline by which arbitration-eligible players must be offered a contract or they become free agents, joining a great unwashed pool of available players. Now, there are a lot of extremely interesting names who were said to be on the bubble. Gary Sanchez of the New York Yankees being one. I don't know if I ever really bought that, but Gary Sanchez of the New York Yankees being one of them. We know now that the Yankees will, in fact, offer him contract. John Gray of the Colorado Rockies, Tommy Pham, also in that group. But, all day long we've been getting reports that different players have not been offered contracts and become free agents. Some of them have gone on social media to say that. We know now, for example, that the Chicago Cubs are going to make Alberto Amora, somebody that Dan Shulman talked about as possibly interesting the Blue Jays, that he will be available, as will Kyle Schwarber. Chris Bryant will likely receive a contract offer. Mark Carrig is a senior baseball writer with The Athletic. He and Andy McCullough have an article up on the website on this year's potential non-tender market. As I said, it's probably not going to change your favorite team's opinion of George Springer, DJ LeMahieu, Trevor Bauer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or maybe even trading for Francisco Lindor. But what some of these names will do, Mark Carrigan, we're glad that you join us, what some of these names will do is certainly present teams with enough plan Bs or plan Cs that they may be less inclined to wait around for the free agents to make up their mind.
Blair, it's like you've covered the sport for a long time. I mean, that's pretty much it, right? I mean, look, the non-tender deadline every year, to me, is sort of the unofficial starting gun for free agency.
Yes, it is.
And I say that because what team, if they've got needs to fill, especially in this environment where dollars are going to be at a premium pretty much all over the sport, except for a couple exceptions, for those teams, you want to have the fullest picture of what players are available for the needs you've got to fill. And I'm going to give you an example. I just saw before coming on here that I think our friend Mark Feinsand of MLB.com reported that Michael Franco is going to be non-tendered. This is the Royals' third baseman, had a really nice little bounce-back season in Kansas City after obviously troubles in Philadelphia. So is that some superstar-level player? No, he's not. Is that a good major league player who is now available for a team that might need a third baseman? Yes, he is. And he's a good enough player where, hey, that now becomes another option. It's another decision to make as far as, all right, how much money are we going to pour into this position? Is this somebody who might be cheaper than another option, say like Justin Turner? And you just multiply that by, you know, dozens of guys. I think those are the decisions that change with the non-tender deadline. What's a little interesting this year, though, is that because of the financial climate in the sport, you got a lot of teams that are motivated to make these calls as far as cutting talent to save money. And as you know, there aren't that many opportunities in baseball to shed salary free and clear. The non-tender deadline is one of them. So given that context with the sport, I think this one took on a little added importance because, you know, teams are trying to shed money.
So, Mark, let me use one guy as an example, and maybe you can take us down to, like, what the likely prospect or end game is. Eddie Rosario clears waivers, meaning that no one is interested in taking him at his arbitration likely number of 9 to $10 million a year. Eddie Rosario is 28 years old. He's let's just take 2019, year before the pandemic year. The guy had 32 homers, 109 RBIs. His OPS was 800, and he got MVP votes. 18th overall in MVP. So this is a good player. I mean, and this is not a guy who's 36, 37 years old. So clearly the Twins don't want him back at the number. So what happens to like an Eddie Rosario, 29 years old, hit 13 homers last year in a very short year, 32 homers, 109 RBIs the year before. I mean, once upon a time, this guy would have been a mega player. What happens to a guy like this now?
Well, some team's about to get themselves a good ball player at probably a pretty manageable number. I think that sort of echoes the point I was trying to make there, is that because you've got teams that are trying to shed salary, given the finances going on in the sport, there are going to be good ball players out there, probably better ball players after the non-tender deadline that you would expect to be out on the market. Eddie Rosario is a great example. He's sort of a funny player, right? Because when you look at the stat line, and you mentioned it, he hits for power. OPS is there. He's also one of those guys who's a good enough player to scrutinize. So the big knock on him is always, well, the on-base skills aren't there. Really doesn't give you anything else besides the power, which is all. I mean, you can make that argument that that's all true. Now, that said, that's still a player that I think under typical circumstances is not getting non-tendered. Okay? Like, I mean, that $9 million, $10 million, I was talking to executives from other teams where it's like, hey, that's pretty reasonable for this guy. And yeah, despite those warts, a little bounce back from him and his production is probably right in line with that number. But the end game is that you know, he's going to walk, right? Minnesota is almost certainly going to non-tender him. That's a team that usually is very careful with their money anyway. I think that becomes accentuated given the lack of revenues that came in this year during the pandemic season. So now you've got this player who, yes, while imperfect, is still a decent, productive major league player. That a team that is has that need, I think that it's good news for them. Is it good news for the player? Probably not. He probably is going to get a deal that is lesser than, you know, what he would have gotten through arbitration, obviously. But if you're a team that is trying to fill a need like that, it's good news for you. And I think there are going to be some teams that pounce on this, because I think there are players that will be of use for some clubs. And I think a lot of what we're seeing as far as the glacial pace of the market so far is just clubs waiting to see what, you know, shakes out after this deadline.
Is it too early to get a read on what the trade market is for Francisco Lindor? Or, you know, is that a move that you think will need to be determined by where, I don't know, where George Springer or DJ LeMahieu go? Like, you know, like I'm looking from the Blue Jays point of view, and everybody's linked the Blue Jays to Francisco Lindor because of Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins, the pre-existing relationships with Cleveland. But, you know, I look at a guy, if I'm the Blue Jays, and I said this in social media, and I've been kind of pilloried for it, but I've been pretty consistent in my stance here. Hey, it'd be great if Francisco Lindor wanted to join the Blue Jays and sign a six-year contract. I'm not certain he's going to do that. I would rather, if I'm the Blue Jays, I'd rather sign Didi, maybe, and ask Bo Bichette if he'd move to second. Apparently, he was thinking about it last year when Didi was a free agent. Sign Didi for 1 year, maybe give him 2 years, knowing that I can always move him in the second year if I need to, and then go after one of those free agent shortstops. You know, if I'm the Blue Jays, I don't want to give up three minor leaguers for 1 year of Francisco Lindor. I don't even know if I want to give up three minor leaguers for 3 years of him.
Yeah, I mean, I think, honestly, like, either of those plans would sound fine to me. And I'm a little biased. I think Lindor is awesome. And I say that not just because of the player that he is, but I think something that, you know, people that kind of cover baseball, we get really into the weeds about, you know, what a player's value is, and you look at numbers, and you look at age curves and all that stuff. But sometimes you overlook this. Francisco Lindor would just be such an asset for a club trying to sell tickets and engender goodwill for their fans. Like, have you ever heard him talk, right? Like, this kid, like, is always happy. He's smiling. He's having fun playing this game. You know, I'm based in New York. I think about Francisco Lindor playing in this town, and it is just, like, an incredible vision. I mean, he's a Puerto Rican kid in a city that has a significant Puerto Rican population. You're reaching a whole new audience, or at least, like, you know, doubling down on the audience maybe that's already there. And I think that kind of stuff is a big deal, okay, aside from the fact that he's also just a hell of a ball player, obviously. Right. So, you know, I guess to your first point, I think there is some truth to that, right, where clubs are sort of waiting to see how things shake out, because if Cleveland is trading Lindor, obviously the motivator there is to shed the salary, and it's a pretty significant one. So, you know, you if you're the team taking him on, like, there's going to be a lot of rearranging that you've got to do to accommodate that money, even if you're parting with prospects, right? So right. I think that's probably an element of this for sure. But, you know, if I were running the Mets, like, I've heard Sandy Alderson say this, you know, they don't want to part with prospects, and I get that because they're really thin, especially in the upper levels of the minors. But I think a player like Lindor is just so special, and you've got a team like Cleveland, by the way, that has shown early signs that, you know, they're trying to shed money at all costs, right? Like, the offseason began with them giving away Brad Hand, you know? Yeah. So I think that's a factor here, too, that the teams ought to keep in mind.
I guess when I look at it from a Blue Jays point of view, though, and you know, look, this team's probably not going to be playing in Canada this year. They are probably going to be playing in Buffalo. So if I'm the Blue Jays, and this is where it gets kind of interesting, and this dovetails with what you're saying. If I'm the Blue Jays, and now we're talking about wanting to build, let's say we're talking about wanting to build a new stadium. We hope we get it in 5 years. You know, then I think a guy like Lindor has a lot of value for it, to you. right? Because you can, you're going to have a good team with him. You're never going to be a bad team with him. You're going to be a good team, a contending team. You can kind of hitch your wagon to it, and away you go. But the only way I trade for him if I'm the Blue Jays is I need to know he's going to be around for 4 or 5 years. Because getting him for 1 year when I'm in Buffalo, that's not selling me any tickets.
Right, right. No, I agree. And then you know what? Like, I at the end of the day, I think whatever deal he's moved in is going to be that kind of setup where the part of the calculation is going to be him agreeing to an extension. I don't see right. it where some team's giving up a boatload of talent for that 1 year, right? And we've seen examples of this in the past where, you know, you're orchestrating that extension, you know, as part of the trade. So that to me feels like the kind of deal that moves forward. I think your points about Toronto are spot on. If this is about a stadium play, then, oh, man, this is the kind of guy you got to get. But you know what? I think the Jays are in a good position because if they go the other way, and you're talking about a player like Didi Gregorius and then some of the flexibility that they already have on their roster, hey, man, that's a pretty solid plan too because Gregorius is a good player, and I think there's going to be a pretty good market for him this offseason, by the way. So not a bad plan by you, I would say.
Mr. Carrig, as always, we appreciate you doing this. Thanks so much. And we're glad to know that we're your favorite road country, as you said in social media.
Always. As always. Thanks for having me, guys.
All right. Mark. Stay safe. That's Mark Carrig, terrific senior baseball writer with The Athletic. And his and Andy McCulloch's piece on the names we could see come available tonight in, what, little less than 4 hours? It's an intriguing piece. There are some really good names out there. Some really good names. I mean, I think the Blue Jays, what was the line in Top Gun? This is a target-rich environment. This is a target-rich environment for the Blue Jays.
That is a good line from Top Gun.
Boy, we're gonna take a break and come back and let Arash Madani set us up for Tim and Sid. I guess today it's Sid and Arash, or Arash and Sid. And we'll talk to Arash, but I'm sure Arash is watching that NFL game right now. I haven't watched a second of it because I'm doing this, but we'll get some of Arash's thoughts on that, and maybe I'll see if I can convince Arash to yank on Sid's chain a little bit with this whole Raptors Christmas Day thing. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So in like 12 minutes, we're going to hand you off to Tim and Sid, or more accurately, we're going to hand you off to Sid and Arash. Do we have Arash Madani with us, Derek? Hello, Arash Madani.
Hello, Jeffrey Blair.
How you doing?
Oh, doing well. Just getting ready for the show, watching a little Pittsburgh-Baltimore.
Hey, there you go. Can you tell Sixero to stop whining about the Raptors and Christmas Day? Jesus.
Was he whining about the Raptors and Christmas Day?
Twitter.
Oh, Twitter. On Twitter.
You know, you think the NBA would show the Raptors some respect for all they've gone.
Whoa, 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 whoa. For getting eliminated in the second round?
Whoa, Mr. Blair. I am disappointed.
So, no, I've been sandbagged.
I am disappointed. Well, like this. First off, do not put this on the shoulders of the incomparable Arash Madani, who's been kind enough, mid-move, I may add, to help me out this week and mid-move. Sit in for Tim McCallum. Oh, he's got things going on,
There's
man.
There's a pandemic on.
He's got, well, Madani, listen, man, moves are happening. The real estate market's doing things.
A different type of movement.
Next stop for Arash is United States Senator
with that kind of money. Good job, Arash.
My apologies. Ideally, Georgia, Richard, and I know which party I'd be running for.
Exactly.
Oh God, Sid, you know I love you, but come on, you were having it with the Raptors fans. You were poking them a little bit, but you don't really care about Christmas Day and the Raptors playing on Christmas Day, do you? Who cares?
Let's forget about that for a minute.
Who cares what Americans think about this? It doesn't matter.
It's not that I care. It's not that Arash cares.
Because Arash doesn't care.
And Arash doesn't care. When Arash doesn't care, you know what's going to happen in the future? He will remain not caring about that topic.
That is very true.
of an I don't care take. It's very difficult. I've tried numerous times. It's what makes him so endearing. My point is, though, and we're going to run. It makes him a rash, the one and only. We are going to run the clip from yesterday's show. And I don't mean to pat ourselves on the back a little bit, but we had Bobby Webster on yesterday, and Arash Madani, in the span of 15 seconds, completely wipes out the opinion that this doesn't matter. He completely wiped out the notion, who cares? We're not going to play it now. It's a tease. Jeff, you're more than welcome to stay on in the first segment, hear it, and then counter. This is fair and equal opportunity radio. But we have the clip from the GM's mouth, a normally reserved Bobby Webster, I may add.
But of
very
course
reserved.
He has to say that.
Yeah,
he can't
playing,
say I don't care.
First off, you don't know what he said.
Hometown crowd.
You don't know what he said. We're going to run the clip again. You don't know. All I'm saying is this answer from Bobby wipes out that entire counter. It's not even
talk
close.
About a, talk about a baby face play in the audience.
God,
come on.
It's a great clip. Arash got it. It's fantastic. And,
guys.
And if Chase Claypool and Juju Smith-Schuster can find a touchdown here for me, my afternoon would be going.
I will say this about Bobby. Bobby and Ross Atkins, I think, have gone to the school of new Toronto GM interviewing, where they're waiting for the 8 to 10 topics and they're fully messaged on them and they're prepared for them and they can almost recite them robotically. I think, Sid, we caught him off guard with the Christmas Day question yesterday. I don't think
like
he had that
me.
On the list.
My tie line was down for 50% of that interview. You got it. I didn't get anything.
But here's the thing, guys. The NBA doesn't want to trumpet the fact that one of their teams was kicked out of its country because of a pandemic. Like,
has nothing to do with that.
The Raptors are not a good news story for the NBA. They really
aren't.
It's
not just that,
Jeff. It's a market that they don't have a team in.
The Raptors don't move the needle south of the border.
Exactly.
Pascal Siakam.
Why are we arguing about this? We all agree with this.
We all agree.
Loud noises.
We all agree.
I'm just saying.
This segment is like Jake Paul versus Nate Robinson.
So more entertaining, Richard, than the main event next with Arash myself. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I'm looking forward to
it. All right,
I'm going to listen.
So am I.
You are both welcome.
If you're
in the car,
bang my head against the wall after the Champions
go
League
ahead.
Outcome.
Oh,
no.
Some things
guys, RG3 is now limping off the field.
Oh my God. Is Kendall Hinton going in? Where are we at with the Ravens QB situation?
3-1 PSG. 3-1 PSG at Old Trafford.
Oh, wow. Man, you, tough day. This was fun.
All right, boys, I'm going to listen to your
show.
I can't guarantee I'll call in, though. I can't guarantee I'll call in.
Christmas Day matters. You can. Christmas Day matters.
Take care, guys. Look forward to it. Arash Madani, Sid Sixero, they're next. John Paul Morosi, Elliot Friedman. Deitch and myself will be back tomorrow. Don't forget, a replay of the Patrick Waugh game tonight, 7 o'clock on Sportsnet. You want to know what all the drama was about, December 2nd, 1995. Big, big, big day. Watch the game tonight on Sportsnet. Have a great night.